STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, dear friends, and welcome to Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kuchel, your host, and thank you for joining me today. I just paused there for a moment because I realized someone recognized my voice when I was at the airport yesterday, a TSA guy. You know, so it's a little unnerving to have a TSA guy greet you by name. Like they know you, right? This was at SeaTac in Seattle. And he said something like, "Hello, Mr. Kuchel." And I thought maybe he saw my ticket or something. I didn't know. And that he had read it. And maybe he just got lucky to pronounce my name correctly, because a lot of people pronounce it differently if they just read it. I'll read it Kuchel instead of Kuchel. But I wasn't sure if maybe he recognized me. So I didn't want to say, "How do you know me?" Or I just said, "You pronounced it accurately. How did that happen?" Something like that. And he said, "Well, I listened to the show," and so that was really sweet. We got to chat a little bit, and I got through the line and out the other side, introduced him to my wife and children, because we were up in Seattle over the week, Thanksgiving week, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. But that was, I forgot to tell the staff about that, but that was kind of a fun little thing when that happened. He's probably listening right now, so recognize the voice. Good for you. Glad you're with us here on the show, and I mentioned that I was gone over Thanksgiving holiday like many of you, and indeed, at the last minute, I ended up traveling on the busiest traffic day, air traffic day of the year, allegedly, and that would be the Wednesday before Thursday Thanksgiving. My understanding is more people travel on that date than any other date. And so my own expectation of getting tickets to travel for my brood, the four of us, was rather low, but it worked out nicely. Let me tell you what happened. I had been teaching down in South Orange County here in Southern California for 2 days at Rick Warren's Saddleback Church, and I'll have more to say about that in just a bit maybe, having spent the earlier part of the week down in San Diego at the Evangelical Theological Society's annual convention there, and so mixing up with a lot of friends, but spending a lot of time behind closed doors writing the solid ground that's due early on my writing schedule, the one that's for January, and it's due early because of all the holidays, so I have to get it out that much earlier than normal, a month and a half rather than a month early, just to make sure that we hit all our marks on the calendar. But I spent a lot of time in my room, during that. Drove up to South Orange County Friday night, spent the night there. My wife joined me Saturday night, and we had our event this weekend. And then Monday morning, driving back with the girls off school for Thanksgiving, only to discover my brother-in-law from the East Coast, kind of sitting on our doorstep, made a surprise trip out to L.A. on his way up north to Seattle to visit my mother-in-law, who no longer lives with us, but actually lives with her other daughter. Some of you know about Trova, my now 96-year-old mother-in-law, that actually when she moved out in March or April or early May, I guess, mowed the lawn the day before she went up. And I mention that because this is her standard behavior. This is how hardy Trova, then at 95, was. She's a sturdy gal. And some of you have seen on my Facebook videotapes of her dragging tree branches and all kinds of stuff. She would take 25-pound sacks of manure, pick them up at the local nursery. They'd drop them in the trunk of her car, and she'd drive it up, and then she'd drag those manure sacks around the property for her various gardening projects. And I think the last time she did that, she was about 93, certainly capable of doing that this year, too. She just didn't get around to it, apparently. And anyway, this is a woman of extremely durable constitution. Unfortunately, though, had a recurrence of cancer, and it appeared that this might be the last opportunity that we'd have to see her, and she'd be going home soon. So in light of that, and we got that information from, we've been in touch, but we got that more alarming information from her brother, and so that was Monday. I said, well, let's just fly out Wednesday, and I'll make the arrangements. We'll go visit Grandma over Thanksgiving. It turns out that she was staying with my sister-in-law about an hour from my sister, where my sister lives. So it was really a great opportunity for the whole family to be together. Family to be together, both my wife's side and my side. And on Thanksgiving Day, actually, I was out at my sister's an hour away, and my wife joined me later in the afternoon with the two girls, having spent the day with a lot of her relatives that she doesn't get to see very often. So it was kind of chaotic, but we got down there, got to spend time with lots of folk, and then the last 3 days spent really with Grandma, and just being together with the grandkids and with my wife and I, and that was satisfying. But as you probably could imagine, a bit bittersweet in the process. One odd thing about this trip, and I know some of you like to hear about these crazy trips because of the odd things that happen. We flew up to Seattle from LAX, and the way our United flight took us, we first flew up to San Francisco and then up to SeaTac, and there was a two-hour time gap in Seattle, which is great because I don't need that much time in terms of layover to get to my next gate. But when you're carting two young kids along and a lot more luggage, and it's always good to have a nice, comfortable margin. Except for when we got on the airplane in Los Angeles, they had mechanical difficulties, had to push the plane back into position, and we sat there for almost 2 hours before we took off. Actually, it was less than that. It was about an hour. But then we were out of the queue and had to get in the queue, and that took more time. And pretty much was eating up all the margin, which means we had to make a mad dash at the last minute to catch our connection out of SFO, San Francisco, to get to SeaTac. And so we're all ready for that, and a whole bunch of other people on that plane concerned about connections, and flight attendant, as they often do, will say, if you don't have connections, please stay seated so those people with connections can get out first. And I've got my wife and my two girls and our carry-on, and we had checked three things. The bigger things, I figured, why carry stuff through the airport? You could check it. We had a two-hour layover in San Francisco. Well, that layover got eaten up, right? And when that plane pulled into the spot, the ding went on to get rid of the seat belts, and off we went down the aisle, dragging our stuff with everybody else packed towards the front. And then the flight attendant said, the pilot pulled too far forward in the parking space. Therefore, we have to put, planes don't have reverse, okay, jets? So we have to reverse, we have to get one of those power carts to push the plane back a foot and a half. And they can't move the plane unless everyone's in their seats. So what little time we thought we had to make our connection got totally eaten up there. When we finally burst from the door of the airplane, I started sprinting. And about 5 minutes later, got to the gate of our connecting flight to Seattle. My children and wife trailing up the rear, far behind me, but they knew where I was headed, so I knew they'd make it eventually. And sure, and fortunately, the gate door was still open, and we made it. Thank God, because the next flight was at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. This was like 1 in the afternoon. And SeaTac is over an hour from where we were going. So we made it, but our luggage did not. And the luggage that did not make it was all of my personal effects. So when I landed, not only did we not have my personal luggage, which had to be shipped an hour away, and it was coming in later that night, but when it was finally driven way out to Gig Harbor area, in the middle of nowhere, it seems, west of Tacoma, nobody was there to receive it. Actually, what happened is the people couldn't find the house, and so they had to take it all the way back, and it finally made it out late on Thanksgiving night, and I wasn't even at that house when it came in, nor were my wife and children. They were with me at my sister's. So to make make a long story short, and you're saying too late for that. I spent the clothes that I put on Wednesday morning, I didn't take off until Friday afternoon. I didn't get a fresh change. So don't they have stores in Seattle? I wasn't any place. The enforcer is just talking to me. Yes, they do. But I wasn't anywhere near Seattle. I was out in the boonies. But I managed, and we managed. And as I said, we had a satisfying time while I was there. So I'm just looking at the lines here, and we are absolutely full up with calls. So having related my little adventure to you, I think I am going to take an early break and then come back and start talking with some of you who have so rapidly queued up for the show. All right? So I'm Greg Kokol. The show is Stand to Reason. I'll be back with your calls in just a moment.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokol can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles, follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Back at you here on Stand to Reason, Greg Kokol, your host. And incidentally, this was the reason that I was gone last Tuesday is because I had not finished my writing assignments, and since I was that were due that week, and since I was going away for Thanksgiving, the last minute I had to spend that Tuesday getting everything together and finishing my writing, the solid ground that was due. And I mentioned being in Seattle. Seattle's kind of rainy, and the first couple of days it was raining, and that's kind of gloomy. But on Saturday morning there was a fresh carpeting of snow on the ground, and the sun was out until we returned on Monday. So it was, we had 2.5 beautiful days of crisp, cool, snowy, snow on the ground, kind of white Christmas feel time while we were in Seattle. So that was a nice little pleasant surprise that we had not expected. All right, let's go with our first caller here in Los Angeles, Rick. Hello, Rick. Rick.
Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. I got a lot of noise in the background, though. Can you do something about
that? Yeah, I'm pulling over right now. I'm driving on the rain right now. So,
That's...
We'll see how it gets better.
Yes.
How does that sound?
Yeah, that's better, and I'm glad you're pulling over, especially. This is a... it's weird to drive in the rain, isn't it? Because we haven't had rain in about a year, but I'm glad to see it coming down.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of things. And plus, I'm trying to get my question in order, so I'm really doing too much right now.
All right. So what's on your mind?
But here's my question. I want to give an objection to the design argument for the existence of God.
All right.
Most arguments that I've heard, they go something like this. Design arguments, they first assert that it's highly improbable that such and such parameters would be fine-tuned for our existence.
Uh-huh.
And that such fine-tuning suggests a designer, thus there's a designer, or something like that. And then I look at that, and then I try to use analogous reasoning, and then it seems to me that we can say that almost anything is designed. For example, you can have I could throw a bottle of ketchup on the floor, and it could splatter and make a particular stain
right.
on the floor.
Right.
And then we might say that stain is highly improbable because it could only exist if
sure.
all these factors were in play. The bottle had to be thrown at such and such angle.
Correct.
It had to have a certain viscosity. All this, and you know, we could make a huge amount of causes that need to be in place in order for that stain to exist.
Sure.
And so I guess I don't know what the inference is. Maybe that it's designed or it's special. It's privileged. It's one of a kind, or I don't know how to label
sure.
it.
Sure. Well, it could be one of a kind. That doesn't mean it's designed. And, Rick, what you are identifying is the exact same objection that I had to how I understood the design argument until I got a more accurate understanding about it. Because the design argument is not simply the claim that certain things are highly improbable, but that they are – but it goes beyond that. If you go to – where is Mount Rushmore? Is that in South Dakota or North Dakota?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. You didn't even know. Where is Dakota? What state's that in? Okay, so in one of the Dakotas, you got Mount Rushmore. If you look at all of the rock formations there in that area, all of them are equally complex and equally improbable. If what you mean is, what is the probability of that precise formation being formed rather than any other formation? I'm just talking now about the mountains in general. And so each that happened, as far as we could tell entirely by naturalistic causes, erosion and all of that, are equally complex and equally improbable. Yet they all seem to happen by natural causes and not by any intelligent design. Okay, I'm with you as far as we've gone, and that's the point that you're just making. But Mount Rushmore has something that the rest of it doesn't have. One could argue that all of the features on those rock, on the rock faces of Mount Rushmore are equally improbable as any of the other crags nearby. The difference is that this highly improbable arrangement, thank you, on Mount Rushmore matches another pattern. And this is the difference this is the second element to the design argument. It is not just high improbability. It is also what's called specified complexity. That you have something that is complex that is specified to something else. So Mount Rushmore is the perfect example because we have four different very clear visages of particular presidents of the United States. Because this improbable combination there on the face of that mountain matches some other thing so precisely, this is an evidence that it's designed. That's the whole point of emphasizing specified complexity. You could look, for example, at the sand on a beach and the water's washing up, and all of these configurations that you see on the beach with the water washing up are developed by naturalistic forces. Okay, you can see the water washing and this, you know, and here you get this effect. And all of the effects, where every grain of sand sits, any particular characterization of that is going to be not only highly complex but highly improbable. Yet there it is, complex and improbable. It took place. But if you have somebody walk through that wet sand with shoes on, or barefoot for that matter, it leaves an imprint that is specified to something known. And this is why when we see footsteps in the sand, we don't think, wow, that is amazing that natural causes would produce something like that. No, we see the specification of it and we infer from it the agent who had walked there with shoes that were made by somebody, you know. And we don't even think twice about it. It's so natural for us to do it. And so those people who are part of the intelligent design movement point out that we know how to infer design from certain effects. We do it all the time. And William Dembski has actually characterized in very clear terms what that process looks like. That's where the term specified complexity comes from. And so since we already know how to do this and we're doing it all the time, maybe we can harness that capability with regards to the origins question. And sure enough, we encounter all kinds of things that satisfy the same requirements for design that we have with footprints and Mount Rushmore and a whole host of other things that we know to be designed because of the nature of the thing we're engaged with. And that's the case here. It isn't just an appeal to a remarkable result that's highly improbable, because as you rightly identified, virtually any result is going to catch up on the floor. This is going to be highly improbable, but it happens. That's not the point. It's that it also conforms to a specify. It conforms to something else that we know that was specified. Look at it. If you dropped your ketchup on the floor and the ketchup, the splatters spelled perfectly a complex sentence, you would not probably be inclined to think that that's just a remarkable coincidence. You would probably be inclined to think that something is going on here that entails intelligence. You might not automatically go to the supernatural, but it depends on the nature of if it was ketchup splattered on the wall that formed a sentence, especially if the sentence said, "Quit throwing ketchup on me," signed wall. You know, right? You would infer something else from that circumstance rather than just accident, and that's what's going on with intelligent design arguments. That so I would say the problem is you just got half of the equation, not the other.
Okay, so I'm with you on the Mount Rushmore. Like when you see a face, I think it matches up. Like you said, to I guess our faces, our human faces. So we say, that match must be proof of design, but. Now, how does that apply to the physical world? Like let's take the configuration of the laws of gravity and the laws of strong and weak nuclear forces.
Sure. Yeah.
What does that match up to? In which then supposedly leads us to infer design. I don't see the match.
The match is that it is a it's not just a incredibly complex state of affairs that leads to the existence of complex life on Earth. It is the particular, in this particular case, the strong and weak nuclear force and all the other constants of physics, I don't know them all because that's not my field, but as well as not just the constants of physics, but all kinds of other things that have to do with gross astronomy, that is the universe taken as a whole, and also localized astronomy like our solar system, there are all of these what used to be called amazing coincidences. Amazing coincidences that all need to be in place before complex life on Earth is even possible. But it turns out we are in a position to view the universe in which all of these incredible things took place that are remarkably fine-tuned. That is, if you're just off, not a decimal point, but a millionth of a decimal point on some of these things, then everything would be radically different. And there's so many of them that the concept of the anthropic principle was raised. And that is, how is it that we have a universe that's so finely tuned that it appears to have anticipated the existence of human beings, anthropic principle, who now can reflect on their universe and wonder why is it that the universe is just this way? Now there are two standard retorts to that. One standard retort is rejoinders, and that is the one you've raised, and that is every possible universe is going to be equally unique or equally improbable. Yeah, thank you. Improbable. And we just happen to be in the universe where we exist to reflect on the improbability. And in response to that, a fairly well-known British philosopher raised a raised an illustration. He said, what if you were a person in the firing line and there were 50 guns trained right at your heart, or and they all went off and none hit you? You could say, well, it's a remarkable coincidence. And in fact, if that remarkable coincidence didn't happen by accident, I wouldn't be around now to reflect on the remarkable coincidence. Or you could say, you know what? Something's fishy here. Probably people didn't aim for me, you know, kind of thing. I don't know if I'm doing justice to the illustration, but you get the point. So someone's going to have to make, any individual looking at this evidence has got to make the judgment call. Does it appear is the best explanation for all these incredibly fine-tuned constants that this is an example of colossal luck, which is what Richard Dawkins says, and that he says the same thing, by the way, with regards to the origin of life from non-life, that we have all of these colossal examples of luck, or is it more reasonable to infer design from that evidence? And it strikes me, not just me, but a whole lot of other people who had been naysayers, that it is more reasonable to infer design from that evidence than just to say it's an example of colossal luck. So you kind of have to, you know, make your own choice on what you think is the most reasonable explanation.
All right, Greg. You're the best. Thanks for helping me out.
All right. Thank you, Rick. I appreciate the call. And Swinburne, Richard Swinburne is the one, I think, who came up with that illustration about the firing line. And, you know, a lot of times, friends, you just have to make your call on this stuff. You're going to have to make your judgment call. And look, if there was only one evidence for the existence of God, and that evidence was the fine-tuned constants of the universe, well, the idea that we have where this is an example of a colossal example of luck is more appealing or more tenable, I think. But when you have a whole bunch of other things that converge, and this is just one of a number of arguments, I think that changes things considerably. Okay. Let's see. Louisiana and Joshua, let's go there. Hello, Josh.
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
Good, good. Good to talk to you.
Thanks. Hey, I was just, thanks for having me on the show, by the way.
Sure.
I was calling because I have a discussion going on with my friend.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty frustrating, and I don't know if it's because I'm wrong, he's wrong, I think he's wrong, but I was just calling to see if maybe you could help me out with this.
Mm-hmm.
He's a reasonably intelligent guy, far more articulate than most people,
mm-hmm.
but he's pretty relativistic in his worldview.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard of a cybernetic approach.
I have not. I've not heard that.
Not.
No.
Okay. Well, basically it focuses on the observer and says the observer is the one that draws the distinctions between things, so things can be relative depending on the observer.
Well, there's a certain truth to that, of course. Whether you're to my left or my right depends on where I'm at. Whether you're large or small depends on the thing that you're comparing something to. And so this is true, that many things are true relative to something else. Okay, there is, in that sense, there is a relativism in operation, but that is not what relativism generally means, at least not when we're having these religious discussions. It isn't that kind of relativism that is in view. It's another kind. But why don't you keep talking, and we'll see if we get there or not.
Okay. And and just to kind of lay a little background for him, he is a Christian. He believes in objective truth to an extent, as long as God declares it.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of what he says is, if I'm not mistaken, it's pretty similar to Hinduism. He's very both and kind, if you understand what I'm saying. If you say one thing's one way or another, he goes, well, it's kind of both and we're both right. And if you try to approach it from a logical point of view, he says, well, that's just that type of epistemology. Hindus would say, you know, that's just a Western
right.
type of approach
well,
to it.
I certainly know that kind of response, and it's just amazing to me that people can still kind of toss that canard out, especially people who act like they've thought about it. Now, because listen, just think for a moment. He says you're mistaken on your view, and he is correct on his view. This is the simplest way to put that exchange. You are mistaken. You are because you are assessing it from a Western viewpoint. People from an Eastern perspective do not assess it like that. For them, it's both and, not either or. Okay? Well, now he's just made a statement that is not either or. It is, I'm sorry, both and, but I'm sorry, but let me back up. Yeah, that is not both and, but is either or. In other words, he is making a clear distinction between an accurate way of looking at something and an inaccurate way, and he's saying that your way of approaching this is inaccurate and his is accurate. He's the both-and guy. You're the either-or guy. He's right. You're wrong. What is that? That's an example of either-or thinking. And I know that it is fashionable to put that on, characterize this as an Eastern way of thinking. The problem is that this is not an Eastern way of thinking. Back up for a second. I'm getting ahead of myself in my talk. That's why I'm getting garbled. It's easy to say, well, this is the way people who think that's Eastern, and they don't think in your Western way. But our Western way is not a Western way. It's a human way that is tied to reality. And the so-called Eastern both-and guys are thinking either-or all the time. And in fact, if they weren't using the same categories that you and I are using and your friend is using, they couldn't talk at all, because there would be no word that had a discernible meaning. Because if when I say jump, my word could mean not jump at the same time. And therefore, it's jump and not jump. Guess what? You don't get anywhere with that. Language depends upon the so-called either-or thinking. And
right.
If you don't have either-or thinking, there is no thinking. This is the kind. It's not an Eastern thing or a Western thing. It is a human thing, because human beings have a way of assessing reality based on categories that fit the way the world actually is. And just kind of making an appeal to the East isn't going to help. And that's why I mentioned your friend. When your friend is correcting you, he is doing the same thing with you in the correction that he says that you should not be doing. Do you see that?
Yeah, and I actually tried to explain that exact thing to him, and eventually, and this kind of all happened at once. And
uh-huh.
You may just deduce this as being absurd by the time we get done, but he actually doesn't reject what I'm saying. He accepts it at the same time in such a way that. And he does this with a lot of things. He makes two things that are antithetical, that, you know, they don't go together.
Mm-hmm.
He says they're true and false, both each at the same time. And I even have like a very short example of something we went through. It's like four statements from each of us, very short. And you can just see the absurdity that follows through from it.
Mm-hmm.
If I have time to give those, it's pretty short.
All right, go ahead. If you have them right there. But I've heard these kinds of things before, and as you pointed out, what they do is they end up in an absurdity, and that means that they are incoherent. They end up having no meaning at all because they contradict each other and cancel each other out. Like,
right.
This statement is a lie, for example.
Is it right.
Yeah. So, well, is that true or is it false? Well, the thing is, it's contradictory, so to call it true or false becomes meaningless. And therefore, it becomes a meaningless statement because it has no truth value, though it purports to, or it seems
right.
like one of those. So it seems to me those statements just end up making our point and not his, simply because you can you can make a statement like that doesn't prove that all knowledge is somehow unreliable, that they are both true and false in the same way at the same time. Even when he's making observations about you, well, this is, let me see if I understand your view, Joshua. Then he states
okay.
it. Then he, I'm just role playing it. Like if he were to say to you, Joshua, your view is this. Well, he takes that statement about what he thinks your view is to be an objective statement of the way things are. He didn't say your view is this and it's not this at the same time. If he would say do that with everything, thinking would not be possible.
It's the only way he could be consistent with his view as well.
Well, that's right. If that's the way we are to work, but he is trading on the either or mentality all the time. And even if he says, well, you're equally right as the other people and everybody's equally wrong, if he wants to say that to sound consistent, he's welcome to do that. But he just nullifies everything there. You are right and you are wrong. And the other side, my side, is right and my side is wrong. There we go. We are both right and we're both wrong. And we mean both right in the same way that we are both wrong. And you think, I need a drink. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or maybe you've had too many drinks or something like that. This is nonsense.
Yeah.
Now, I think Ravi Zacharias' response to this is classic because it's so simple and straightforward. He says that in the East, and he's from the East, he's from India, he said, people, when they go to cross the street, both look left and right before they cross the street. And he said, why do they do that? Because it's either the truck or me. It's either the truck or me. And his point, I think, is really a valid one. We can philosophize about all of these other things till the cows come home. Actually, that's a good little metaphor for India. Till all the cows come home, because they're all over. But when it comes to actual living, we don't live that way. We live and think in a way that's consistent with the way the world is, with reality. It's not Western. It's not Eastern. It's a human ability from all time that we have had that has allowed us to make sense out of our environment, you know. And I'm not sure what else to say. Some people are just so caught in this that they don't want to. It's almost like a philosophical game to them. And it is so funny, too, that the person that you are talking about identifies himself as a Christian and then says, but there is objective truth as long as God declares it. Really? How does he know what God declares if the rules that he has just identified are not in play? The rules that he is just rejecting are not in play.
I've wondered that as well.
Yeah. How do you, subject, verb, sentences, grammar, these are all based on very specific things that are not both and kind of things. A subject is not a verb, and a verb is not the subject in terms of the role it plays in the sentence. They're separate. Something is acting. If you don't get those right, you don't have God's word. You don't know what God's word is saying, I guess is the best way to put it. One other thing I wanted to mention here in this discussion, and you might ask him about this or just bring it up. Do you know what a Zen koan is? K-O-A-N?
No.
It's a riddle. And the most famous Zen koan is, or cone, some people call it that. The most famous Zen cone is something about the sound of one hand clapping. Now, how can one hand clap? Well, it can't if you're into either-or thinking. But with Zen Buddhism, what they want people to do is they want them to reflect on this koan in order to shake them out of their either-or thinking so they're into both-and thinking. And there's a whole bunch of these statements that are used to help accomplish that effect. Okay, you with me so far? You've heard about the sound of one hand clapping. Well, this is...
like once, maybe twice.
Yeah, okay. Well, others listening, I'm sure, are familiar with it. But now here's the key, though. Who are these Zen koans given to consider? They're given to people in their culture. Which culture is the East? These people aren't locked in both and thinking. They are locked in either or thinking because that's the way reality works. And even their own religious masters have to work hard with them, offering them nonsense statements to help shake them out of their either or thinking and help them to think more expansively consistent with this Zen philosophy. So it is not a West versus East, because even in the East they think like the West in that regard. And the whole idea of these Zen koans is to get someone to get rocked out of their, I think, their rational thinking, which is absolutely appropriate. So anyway, that's something you might point out, and it's meant the fact that there are these Zen koans is evidence that it's not just Westerners who think this way naturally. It's Easterners who think this way naturally, and it's because it's not an East-West thing. It's a human thing, and I think it's a human thing because it's tied to reality. It's the way the world is, and just basic reflection on the nature of the world, I think, will allow people to see that that's a truism.
So, okay.
All righty.
All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
All right, Joshua, good talking to you, and appreciate your call. Let's go to break, and I'll come back with more of your calls on Stand to Reason.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors. And your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273, or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Greg Kokel here, one of the good guys, giving you something worth thinking about every week on our show. 3 hours from 4 in the afternoon to 7 in the afternoon evening on Tuesdays. That's our live show, I like to say. For those outside of Southern California, 3 hours is not burdensome. It's just one L.A. commute, and people in Los Angeles understand that. Most others don't, but that's kind of the way it is for a lot of folks. So it isn't burdensome, 3 hours a week. Easy and a great addition to your education, I think. As a thinker, regardless of what side of the aisle you show up on, philosophically speaking or religiously speaking, I like to think that I'm maybe helping naysayers or skeptics to be more skilled or accurate or capable in their thinking by listening to the show, even if they don't share my views. Let's go to George in Arizona. And George, my apologies that I should have picked you up earlier, but I just got confused myself, so that was my bad. Glad to have you on board, though.
Oh, no problem. You're a grace-based ministry, and I appreciate that.
Well, thanks.
It's good to have you back.
So you're extending the grace to me. Yeah.
Yeah. My wife and I have a question for you. We want your perspective on this issue. As you know, Arizona has recently legalized same-sex marriage, and my wife is a paralegal, and we're not sure that she's going to be asked to process paperwork to facilitate an adoption for a same-sex couple, but it's possible. And I'm not sure if her attorney can decline this case. I'm not sure the legality of that and whether this turns out to be another bakery issue.
Right, right.
But if she were called upon to do this paperwork, we see this as a line in the sand issue where we're not going to participate in facilitating this evil, what we would consider evil, placing an innocent child in a same-sex couple's house and, you know, formal adoption.
Sure. Let me ask a question, though, just about that, just for the sake of clarification. And by the way, this is something I think that you and your wife need to be clear on for yourselves. Is your moral objection that they are going to be in a home with practicing homosexuals or lesbians, or is your objection that you are placing, you are facilitating a circumstance in which a child is guaranteed not to have a mother or a father, one or the other?
Well, I think the objection is, well, first of all, I'm going to assume the same-sex couple is an unbeliever, and the child is an innocent unbeliever, and we're going to put them in to be in a situation there where they're a parent being parented by a same-sex couple. So our objection is that this is an evil practice. Therefore, we should not participate in it.
Sure.
Even if it means losing her job, she can always get another job.
Okay, George, here's where the I need the clarification.
Okay.
What is the evil because you're putting an innocent child under the care of non-believers? Because that's the way it sounded to me just a moment ago.
Well, they're both non-believers. Everybody's an unbeliever. The child's an unbeliever, probably.
Yes, but if your objection is that you're placing the child with unbelievers and that's evil, then it doesn't matter whether they're same-sex or not. If they're unbelievers, that's the thing you don't want to participate in. You only want to participate in adoptions where an innocent child goes to Christians. I think that's going to be much more difficult to defend. And I'm not even convinced that it is immoral for children to be placed in homes with unbeliever parents. God seems to be doing it all the time.
Right. No, I
through natural
agree with that.
Childbirth is what I mean. Okay.
Yeah.
So, as you pursue this issue, you have to be very, very clear in your own mind so that you can communicate clearly to others the thing that you are morally objecting to. And the way you explained it to me sounded like you're morally objecting to a child being placed in the care of unbelievers.
No, I would not. That's not the issue.
That's not
the issue.
In my
mind, no, I wouldn't say that's the issue. We don't approve of same-sex marriage.
I got you.
And, well, you've got me thinking, Greg.
Okay, well, if it were me, here's how I'd put it. If I were in your position, I would put it this way. As a matter of moral conviction, I believe it's wrong to place a child with a family that of a same-sex couple. Now, my objections have nothing to this objection that I'm giving. I'm being very precise. Has nothing to do with any of their sexual preferences. It has to do with the idea that a child deserves to have a mother and a father, and that matters, and that we would be engineering a circumstance in which a child would be denied something that is really, really critically important to their development. Now, can children get by without it? Sure, but we should engineer that. Now, we understand that sometimes marriages break up and there is death in the family or widower, whatever, but we would never we should not be engineering something like that where a child goes to a family where we are organizing it or determining that they will not have a parent that they need. And so that is your personal moral conviction, and this is what needs to be stated. You don't have to put it as your religious conviction. In fact, if strategically, I wouldn't say this is, I don't think I'd say this is my religious conviction, because then somebody could argue against that biblically for you. And the point is, it should be, you should be able to say no something, to know something, you should be able to say no to something simply in virtue of your own moral convictions. How those moral convictions are grounded, biblically or otherwise, is a separate question. That they are your moral convictions and that you can give reasons for them ought to be adequate. So that would be the way I would argue. I would not argue, I don't think homosexuality is moral. I'm not going to place the children in a home where there are homosexuals, because it could be that there are people of other that are not homosexuals but have other moral problems that you place children in their home anyway. So this then becomes an impossible job to participate in, because you could always find something wrong with a couple, it seems to me. So that's not the grounds on which I would object. I would object on the grounds of gender. Children need a mother and father. Attorney, employer, if you want to place them like that, then maybe you're legally obliged to do so, fine. I'm expressing my desire not to be included in that process because I have moral difficulties with being part of that.
And I believe the statistics show the validity of that point of view, that a child needs a mother and a father.
Yeah, and we ought not need people in white coats that expound on this, because it seems obvious, and most mothers and fathers understand that point clearly. But the work is coming out nowadays that is supporting that notion. Okay, that children flourish best in homes with a mother and a father. Now, is two mothers and two fathers better than an institution? Yes, I would say so. But normally, that's not the choice. The choice isn't between an orphanage and two mothers or two fathers. The choice is between two mothers or two fathers, or a mother and a father that might be equally qualified as the two fathers or two mothers, the same-sex couple. And right. In those cases, I think that the mother and father ought to, the male-female couple ought to always trump the same-sex couple. Now, this is virtually impossible to do anymore legally because of same-sex marriage. This is precisely the point that we've been making for a long time. Once you have same-sex marriage, you have the government declaring by fiat that there is no difference between same-sex unions and heterosexual unions. They're exactly the same with regards to the law, and therefore they must be treated the same. And the minute you make distinctions, like, for example, in adoption, then you're breaching the spirit of that law. And therefore, this breach becomes actionable. Policy is then set as if same-sex couples and heterosexual couples function exactly the same across all categories in society. And this is just obviously false. But this is what we're strapped with when you have same-sex marriage laws. And this is something I've been predicting for a long time. But this is one example of that. Okay, but so in your situation, what I would suggest, George, for you and your wife, she works for a firm, a law firm, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, well, the law firm has legal obligations as a firm that she does not have as an individual, is my suspicion.
Right.
So it may be that the law firm has to process this, and the law firm is willing to. But that doesn't mean that your wife has to participate.
Correct.
And it seems to me that you can go to the attorney, to the partners or whoever, and to the boss, and say, I have moral qualms about this. And leave it at that. I think this is morally wrong. They could ask for the rationale, and you could say, because I think children need a mother and father. And that it when we place them with the same-sex couple, when equally adequate heterosexual couples are available, then I think that's something wrong. So I would be very happy to participate in all the other things that don't violate my conscience. But my request is that you not place me on cases that violate my conscience. There is no good reason why the partners should not honor that, unless they are trying to coercively enforce political correctness?
Well, I would not think that would be the case.
Okay. Then you might be out from underneath this, and they would honor that and say, okay, you don't have to do that. We'll have somebody else take care of that. Fine. Then you're clear. You don't have to act in a way that violates your conscience.
Well, thanks so much, Greg. You've been very helpful.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm glad I have been. And give me a call in a couple of months whenever you cross this bridge and let me know what happens, okay, George?
Sounds wonderful. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks for your call. We are going to see more and more of this. I've been talking about it quite a bit. George made reference to the line in the sand. This, as many of you know, is the title of the latest Solid Ground that just came out within the last couple of days. Yesterday, most of you got your copy. If not, it'll be coming either snail mail or online. But I want you to consider what I've written there carefully, because this is no small matter. I did mention in the article that homosexuality and same-sex marriage, I think, are theologically, I don't think I used the word inconsequential. Somebody challenged me on that recently in an email, but I was certainly give it the. I was making the point that these issues are low on the theological pecking order, and all I meant by that is this isn't something like the deity of Christ, or the resurrection, or blood atonement, or the Trinity, or those kinds of things that we've always considered to be cornerstones of classical Christianity. It doesn't mean that this is a non-issue or it's irrelevant. It's not. Even in itself, it's very significant and it's morally weighty, but it is not on par with those other issues. But because it's not on par with those other issues does not mean that at this time in our cultural history that we have we have liberty to kind of give it the short shrift, say, oh, it's no big deal, let's just go along with it, because even though it's lower on the theological pecking order, it still is significant theologically in itself, but it plays a really significant role strategically in what's happening in culture. And this is the point at which the culture is telling the church what the church is to be like. Instead of God informing the church what the church is to be like, it is the culture telling the church what the church will be like. And I think we need to make a stand at this point. This is a line in the sand that that our caller was referring to. We need to stick tight to that. Because there's another line being drawn, I mean, another issue, and that's religious pluralism. The same challenge that we're getting on homosexuality, celebrate diversity, join us, we're going to get on religious pluralism, just another type of diversity, and that we are bigoted and narrow-minded and arrogant and intolerant if we don't acknowledge that all religions are equally legitimate. And this, my friends, is right at the top of theological importance. I'm concerned if we fail on the first, we will fail on the second. And so that's why the line in the sand is so important. All right, that's it for this hour, friends. I hope you read this month's Solid Ground. If you haven't gotten it, go to str.org and you'll get it. I've got hours ahead of me. Hopefully you'll join me for that on Stand to Reason.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show, friends. The show is Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel here, your host. Glad to have you. Looking forward to this next hour. I got lines full up here, which is a wonderful sight to see, all these flashing yellow lights. And I'll be getting to your calls very shortly. I did want to mention something I brought up the last hour, and that is I spoke for Rick Warren last week. He was last weekend. That is the weekend before last, now I think about it, the weekend before Thanksgiving. He had an invitation to come out and cover the services that he would be missing because he was in the Vatican speaking at a consortium, a colloquium on marriage. And this was also their weekend for apologetics, and they've done this a number of years in a row. The first 2 years I was part of that event, where it's kind of like a weekend conference for apologetics in which a different speaker is at each of the five or six services, depending on how they divide it up. And the services that Rick usually preaches at, they have a different speaker at. And I think the first year, people like William Lane Craig and J.P. Moreland and Dinesh D'Souza and myself, one other speaker, I'll think of his name in a minute. But it was a lineup of different people, so they had different talks at different sessions, and people could come to multiple sessions if they wanted to, or at least watch the recording on the internet, so that congregation can be educated in things pertaining to the defense of the gospel. Now, I know that Rick Warren has been a bit of a lightning rod in some ways for Christians, and he's received criticism for different things. And I have actually taken some heat from some for appearing on a stage because this appears to many people as an endorsement of Rick Warren, and this is raises issues for many Christians. Now, just for clarification, if Rick asks me to speak on his stage, this is not an endorsement of me of him. This is an endorsement of him of me. That is, when a group invites a speaker to speak, it is the group's endorsement of the speaker. The speaker will go any place that the speaker would like his own message to be heard. And that's pretty much my philosophy. I go to a lot of university campuses. In fact, I was at Texas A&M about 2 months ago, and I showed up on their campus. Does this mean that I am endorsing everything that is taught at Texas A&M? No, not at all. It means that they're willing to have me on their campus to express my own views. That's what that is. So I'm not trying to distance myself from Rick. I have a lot of admiration for things that he's done, and I am glad to be able to be part of that congregation and communicate the things that I know. And when I was there the first time, I talked about Columbo. Well, that's evangelism. Right? Why do you do evangelism? Because people need the gospel, right? So that's pretty basic. I was asked to do that. The second time I was asked to teach on the cross and the resurrection, which I did. It's called two miracles, the miracle of the cross, the miracle of the resurrection. And in communicating the miracle of the cross and the miracle of the resurrection, I was able to give a very, very clear characterization of substitutionary atonement, justification, the grand exchange, And that we need Jesus to be saved. And I was there by invitation once again because Rick knows what I was going to speak on. Indeed, he encouraged me to speak on that. This weekend was their apologetics weekend, but I was invited to do all the services. And so in five services, I did four different talks. That means I doubled up on Columbo. So I did Ambassadors for Christ Saturday, the first service. I did Columbo, the second service. Then Sunday morning, the first service, did Columbo again. Second service, contend earnestly for the faith. And those of you who know this talk know this is a hard-nosed call to solid gospel representation, in the face of trouble in the church and trouble in the world. And I spend most of my time in 2 Timothy. Pass the baton. Guard the gospel. Pass the baton. That's the whole message. That from his stage. And then the final talk I gave was called Facing Your Friends Without Fear. And this is to a younger audience, the last service at 6 o'clock on Sunday night. And I cannibalized a number of talks to put this together. How do you deal with your friends with confidence? How do you face your friends without fear? And I had three basic points. One was that you need a plan, and that plan has two parts. First part, put a stone in their shoe. Don't try to win everybody to Christ the first time you meet them. Just try to put a stone in their shoe. Get them thinking. The second part is you do that by using questions. Columbo tactic. Okay? So that's the plan. Secondly, you need some knowledge. You need to know a few things. You need to know the gospel. Critical. You also need to know how to dodge certain kinds of challenges. And I mentioned some techniques for doing that. And the final thing, and that's dealing with the problem of pluralism, for example. Why pluralism? That all roads lead to Rome. Religiously speaking, this is just dead on false. It's not bigotry to say it's false that all roads don't lead to Rome. It's just simple math. Religious views radically contradict each other. They can't all be right. In fact, they can all be wrong, but they can't all be right. And indeed, that means that 90% of the people are mistaken on their religious views. Maybe I'm one of them. That's certainly possible in a certain sense. But the point I'm making is that pluralism self-destructs. And then I taught some things about how to deal with that. And then finally, I said you got to have a line in the sand. We have to have a line in the sand. Ours, not theirs. We dictate that line. And if you don't have a line in the sand in these days, a line that you will not cross, a line that identifies your faithfulness to Christ, then you're going to be a casualty. You'll have friends, but you won't be facing them without fear. You'll be joining them without fear. And we're in a time where we have to decide what side we're going to be on, ultimately speaking. Now, at this point, and I talked a bit about what I wrote in the Solid Ground that just came out yesterday. At this point, I had quoted Rick at the end of my piece here, The Line in the Sand. I talked about my own material in that article, but I also talked about the significance of this line in the sand. Now, Rick Warren had been in the Vatican all week long, and he had delivered an address on marriage while in the Vatican. And I got a chance to view that address on Friday night before the Saturday and Sunday that I would speak. 47 minutes long, something like that. And it is a crystal clear, uncompromising defense of the biblical view of marriage over and against the rising popularity of same-sex marriage. And what Rick Warren said here is the church cannot cave in on this issue. I think that's a direct quote. Indeed, that quote was captured in the heading of some article that I saw on the web regarding what he had to say. Now, for many of you who have been unhappy with Rick Warren for whatever reason, I'm not going to take that on now. I understand the concerns as you've expressed them. Fine. But when a guy like that steps up and says it right, which I think he did in this, I think we ought to tip our hat, at least in this regard, to him and acknowledge that. I think he did a grand job. And indeed, one of his last lines in that address at the Vatican was one of my last lines in my talk that Sunday night. And here's what he said. When God's word is clear, we must not, we cannot back up, back down, back off, backslide, or give in. Well, I agree with him there, and I hope you do as well. And I'm glad that he took such a strong stand, making common cause there at the Vatican regarding marriage. All right, having opened, let's go now to some of your calls in Jacksonville, Florida. Let me find the number here. Hello, Craig, and welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, Greg, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And very apropos, I guess, based on the topic that I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
My wife and I would like to open up a bakery. And it poses some problems for us, obviously, because of our religious convictions and the way that our culture is headed. And you could even maybe say question the wisdom of entering into that type of business.
That was the first thing that crossed my mind when you said that. But you're a brave man, Craig.
Well, like I said, we have, you know, I just have to give you a lot of credit, Greg, for just shaping so much of our thinking and causing us to live our lives much more intentional. And there's a lot of aspects about the bakery that we want to do that it's more kingdom oriented than just satisfying people's sweet tooth. But that's another discussion.
Well, good for you.
But I know that in other states there's legislation that has been passed. Mississippi recently, Arizona, the legislator passed it, but the governor vetoed it. But it was basically a religious expression freedom laws that allowed you to mm-hmm. not have to violate your conscience in conducting business and whatever. And so I have an appointment to talk to my state legislators, and I've forwarded them copies of the Arizona law and the Mississippi law. And I think there's about five other states that are considering this type of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to anticipate and answer objections and that sort of thing.
Correct.
And the pushback that I seem to get the most and the one that I'm having the most difficulty retorting is people say, well, if that type of law is passed, then that just opens the door for all kinds of abuse from all sorts of quote-unquote religious organizations. You know, it's the cult of the flying spaghetti monster that doesn't want to serve Christians, and so we're not going to. Or, you know, our religion, we hate women, so we're not going to serve them. And I don't know how to respond to that type of objection to legislation like this that's, you know, intended to protect religious liberty.
Yeah. Well, a couple of thoughts here. The first one that came to mind even before you asked your question was, is it not a sign of the times that such a law that you're discussing in Arizona that got vetoed, et cetera, that a separate law has to be passed in order to protect what I think prior to this general time would have been considered a first freedom guaranteed by the Constitution? You know, why it's like the Baby Born Alive Act. Wait, you mean we actually need a law that says any baby born alive after an attempted abortion ought
right.
to be allowed to live? I mean, we have to pass a law? I thought that was like a no-brainer. They're alive, right? This
yeah.
isn't a potential life. This is, but still, that's the way it's gone. And so now we have to try to pass these laws to secure for us explicitly what the First Amendment is supposed to secure for us implicitly. It no longer does that. So this is, in my view, this is just a sign of the times. Okay. Secondly, all laws discriminate.
Mm.
They discriminate regarding the particulars of the law. So I have a driver's license, but my 9-year-old does not. Why not?
Right.
She's not allowed to have a driver's license. Why not? She's 9. Well, that's age discrimination. Well, yes, it is age discrimination, but it's based on something other than mere age. Mere age relates to her capability of fulfilling the responsibility that that driver's licenses provide for people. You know, so nobody screams foul because because a 9-year-old is not allowed to have a driver's license based on discrimination. And
right.
could you hear somebody saying, you know, if you pass a law and saying that the 9-year-old, if your law doesn't provide for the 9-year-old, pretty soon you're going to have all kinds of other people with their own exemptions, their own concerns, and pretty soon you're going to have blacks not getting driver's licenses and atheists not getting driver's licenses and on and on and on. But of course, you see the difference, don't you, between a 9-year-old being denied a driver's license and a black person being denied a driver's license.
Right.
Yeah, because the age is relevant to the issue where the skin color is not relevant to the issue. All right. Now, you just compare this to the idea of same-sex marriage. There are two kinds of applications here. One is an application just in general. Our objection to same-sex marriage is regarding the issue itself, and it is not the same kind of thing as objecting to interracial marriage, because skin color is irrelevant to anything about marriage, and sex is central to marriage, or at least this seemed obvious to everybody until just recently.
Right.
So a case can be made that we are talking about apples and oranges here, and therefore it is not appropriate to kind of cry foul in the sense that there is parity between not allowing same-sex marriage and not allowing interracial marriage. There's no parity at all. The only thing that's the same in both cases is that you're not allowing two people to get married, or you're not publicly affirming or licensing the act. All right. And but there's a rationale there, at least arguably. Now, the same thing is true if you were a baker and you said, I don't want to have to participate in same-sex unions. Now, this is where precision is really important, and it is also a place where, let's say, naysayers from the other side refuse, it seems, to countenance such precision. In the state of New Mexico, where there was an action in 2013, went to the Supreme Court of New Mexico against photographers regarding same-sex marriage, and this, they didn't have a same-sex statute, but they did have civil rights statutes that were in violation here. The photographer said, we do not want to photograph a same-sex union. Now, these same photographers regularly photographed homosexuals. So this was not animated by hostility towards homosexuals. It was animated by a concern for a certain type of that's the word I'm looking at, procedure or celebration or tradition, or what's the word I'm looking for? I can't find it. By the marriage itself, by this activity, this
ceremony or something.
Thank you.
Like that.
Mm-hmm. Why was that so hard? Ceremony. Yeah. So the objection is against the ceremony, and the objection is principled. An argument can be advanced that is principled with regards to not participating in the ceremony. It's irrespective of sexual preference. It has nothing to do with sexual preference. And people say, of course it does, because these are homosexuals that are getting quote-unquote married. I said, well, this isn't always the case, because there's been a number of cases of late that have made the news where heterosexuals are getting married under same-sex marriage statutes. Now, why would they want to do that? Well, they have their own reasons, but, you know, they're not sexually motivated.
Mm-hmm.
And this drives the homosexual crowd batty, because this seems to be abuse. Well, who are they to say? You know, that's their line. Who are you to say? We got our rights. They have their rights, too. If heterosexual men want to get married, who's to say that they shouldn't if the law makes provision for that? Point I'm making is the photographer or you as a baker, your objections is to a ceremony that authenticates something that should not, that you have moral problems with. You have conscience difficulties, so you shouldn't have to participate in that. Somebody else can do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not getting in the way of anybody's first freedoms.
But this, I mean, if your argument going forward is based on, you know, and I'm completely with you. My argument is partially religious and partially, you know, the harm that it does to our culture. But, you know, if I say, well, I want this law passed to protect my religious liberty,
right,
then why couldn't somebody come forward and say, well, my religious, the way that I express my religious, myself religiously, is to discriminate against blacks. And so, there, you know, what would keep them from saying something
because
like that?
Because ours is not a mere religious claim. We are not just merely saying, it's my religion that black people are what? I don't know what. Wrong? Bad? That skin mm-hmm. color is bad? I mean, this is this isn't the kind of claim we're making. I think the response that could be given to the person there regarding the discriminating against blacks is that their one's skin color is irrelevant to anything significant or important. It's totally irrelevant. But it's my religious conviction. Okay, well, you don't get everything you want by just labeling a religious conviction. And this has never been the case in American jurisprudence. They draw lines in certain ways. This, however, is an entirely different circumstance. We can present an entire, a complete rationale regarding same-sex marriage and the concerns about same-sex marriage, both biblically, religiously, culturally, down the line. And since our views are not just baldly discriminatory, but they are making legitimate distinctions based on good, solid reasons, it is not in the same category as those who say, it's my religious preference to have nothing to do with blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody explain to me then, from your religious view, I'd be interested in hearing this. Give me a theological characterization why you having to serve blacks violates your religion. I can do that with regards to same-sex marriage. How can you do that with skin color?
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
So that's the difference. That's the basic difference, what I've just described. It is not just a mere and somewhat blind religious preference. Hey, I just don't like redheads. So I shouldn't be forced to officiate at any redheaded wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's pretty silly. This is not silly, though. If it were silly, then why? How is it that from the beginning of time until now, nobody thought of same-sex marriage? It didn't even come up on the radar. In fact, when the Supreme Court was considering this an aspect of this issue a year or so ago, one of the U.S. Supreme Court justices said...
it was it's newer than the cell phone. So
yes,
tread carefully.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, how have people missed this all this time? Because it's grounded in the way reality is structured, the way human beings are, the way males and females are created, or however you want to put it. You don't have to ground it religiously, but it's just like I said, it's the nature of reality.
Yeah, so, I'm with you, and I think about these issues, and I hear. Yeah, because I try to keep up with what's going on legally in this area, and then I just don't understand just the thinking on this. It's just so poor.
Yeah.
It baffles me.
Well, the reason that it's difficult, I don't think it's difficult to see. I think people are so completely, and here's my word, prejudiced regarding this issue. They are so completely prejudiced with regards to this issue. That is, they got their blinders on, they believe what they want to believe, and they're going to have their way no matter what. And reason means nothing to this group, nothing at all. They want what they want when they want it. And so you can give all the best rationales going, and they're not going to listen. They're going to get their own way. They're going to use force if they have to, but they're going to get their own way, and they're going to punish dissenters. And that's just the way it's going here. So I think these things are pretty straightforward and obvious. They've been obvious to human beings for millennia and with no exceptions. And all of a sudden, all of civilization has missed this really important thing called same-sex marriage that is such a profound violation, if they don't have it, of human rights, that even those people who have moral scruples or religious or conscious scruples about it must be forced to participate in it. I mean, do you see? This is so completely bizarre. Hey, let me ask you a question. Craig, you're thinking about going to this business. What are the chances that you could be a successful business if you did not do weddings, period?
It's interesting that you say that because we have thought about that, and a lot of times when we travel, we visit other bakeries just to get other ideas. And there's a very successful bakery in Atlanta. In fact, they have 5 different locations, and they don't do any weddings at all. And I always before, because my wife doesn't even really like to do wedding cakes, but there's just so much money in them.
Mm-hmm.
And
So we were just really excited to see that there was this bakery that they don't do wedding cakes at all. In fact, they don't even do birthday cakes. Mm-hmm. They just make these one cakes, and they're like, we don't write on them, we don't do anything. And
yeah, people can use it for whatever they want, yeah.
Yeah, they're extremely successful at it. And so that was, you know, I do know that there are bakeries out there that they're like, you know, we just don't do it. And that's a possibility. We've thought very hard about that
as
well.
Yeah, well, there's this chain called Nothing Bundt Cake, something mm-hmm. like that. And I don't know, I think they just make Bundt cakes, B-U-N-D-T, you know. And mm-hmm. they're a high-end boutique kind of bakery. And I guess if people want to buy a bunch of those Bundt cakes for their wedding, they can order a big bunch of them and carry them to their wedding. But you can make all the Bundt cakes you want, and people can do whatever they want, and that's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But so maybe, I don't know. That's my suggestion. If you're going to go into the business, you might want to countenance, as a matter of policy for your organization, not doing specialty bakery stuff, I mean, wedding stuff, so you don't, you know, then everybody's being treated equally.
Right.
It's just on the radar for you.
All right.
Thanks
for your time.
Yeah, Craig, good talking to you. I appreciate the call and the role that we've been able to have in your life, Craig.
God bless.
All right, thanks. Bye. All right, let's go to a quick break and then back to your calls on Stand to Reason.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Stand to Reason's new Quick Reference app is now available for free on Apple, Android, and Windows mobile devices. The STR Quick Reference app summarizes the information you need to know about tactics, abortion, and other relevant topics through text and video, equipping you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the most important issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Download the STR Quick Reference app today and be prepared to respond with knowledge, wisdom, and character everywhere you go.
Basic training for your mind, that's Stand to Reason. And I'm Greg Kokel, your host, with you every Tuesday night for a live show from 4 until 7. And that means if you want to call, as many have today, and the calls continue to come in, which is fabulous. Love talking to you guys. Makes my job easier. I don't mind talking by myself. I got a lot to talk about, but it's a little more fun to interact with you. And if you'd like to call, those are the times you call. Los Angeles time here, West Coast, 4 to 7 Tuesdays, and so you can do the numbers. Wherever you happen to be living in the U.S. or the world, for that matter, if you're outside the U.S., the number's 562-424-8229, 562-424-8229. I think one is the international dial code. And if you're here in anywhere in the States, 855-243-9975, 243-9975, 855 area code. We got Josh in New Jersey, so let's talk with him. Josh, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello?
Hello, sir.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. Good to talk to you, Josh.
All righty. Well, I am a long-time listener and first-time caller, and just wanted to say thanks for your ministry before I get to my question.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad we're helping you out.
Okay, so just a little background behind my question. I am a seminary student, and I have been involved in hospital ministry in the past.
Yeah.
And one of the, as a volunteer, you're really, you're significantly limited in what you're allowed to do regarding patients. But now that I'm in seminary, I have the opportunity to do field education in a hospital, which would move me on a path to become certified as a hospital chaplain.
Uh-huh.
The difficulty, however, is that one of the things that they are asking you to do is to be able to basically how they describe it as speaking the voice of those with other faiths, which is kind of code for becoming the priest to whatever the religion the patient is. So if they're a Buddhist, you have to be like the Buddhist priest, or I don't know what they call it. Or for the Muslim, you have to become the imam for them. And I already know, like, for myself, for my personal convictions, I'm not willing to do that. But at the same time, I want to be like I want to be salt and light in there, because if we back out, who else is going to be there to do it? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So the consequences are, if I were to pursue this and a situation comes up where I'm actually asked to perform these services for a patient and I refuse, I could potentially lose my field education credit and all that stuff if it happened now. But if it happened later when you're actually working, you could lose your job, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So my real question is, is it worth even really pursuing this if you kind of know in the long run how things might turn out?
Right. Well,
you know what I mean?
Sure, of course. Josh, I think that is a very wise question that you're asking, and I wish more would ask this kind of question. Counting the cost now and making a decision now about what you will do in the future if you encounter a circumstance like this. It is always much better to be, in a sense, mentally prepared for the eventuality, and then you're not caught by surprise in a different way. Because since you're doing your thinking in advance here, gee, it may be that you say, if I get in that situation, I don't want to be in that situation. I'm going to get fired, so maybe I shouldn't go in that direction to begin with. So the issue you're raising is really, really sound. It is wise that you're doing it now. And so I think listeners can take counsel just from that itself. I have a couple of thoughts about this, and I understand, the rationale. That is, well, I have some restrictions here. But maybe even with the restrictions, in a certain sense, I can still be salt and light. Now, I think in a lot of cases that's kind of what you said. So I think in a lot of cases that would be kind of the guiding principle. So let's just say you're a teacher in a school and you are not allowed to proclaim.
Hello?
Pardon me? Josh? Did we lose you, Josh?
You still there, Greg?
Oh, yeah, there you go. Okay, I can hear you. Can you hear me? God, I guess not. Rats. Oh, that must be a cell phone thing. That's all I can think of. Josh, let me just keep responding here. And if you go away, maybe you'll come back. you might want to call me back. There's open
Greg,
lines.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here, Josh.
Okay, sorry, I couldn't.
Okay,
did you hear you
hit your mute button or something by accident?
I don't think so. Okay. I can put you on speaker, but I know when people do that, you can't hear.
Right. This is fine. Okay. I'm glad you're back. Now I'm thinking of my line of thought here. Okay. So the salt and light is what we're talking about here. Now, if you were a teacher and in your role as a teacher, you are limited in what you could say, I can see how a person can do the best they can under the limitations and be salt and light, even though in a restricted sense. Okay, that makes sense to me. And so don't abandon the public school system where you can do some good, even though you can't do all the good that you want. Okay, good. Because then there's no witness there. Got it. Now, right. But this strikes me as possibly a different kind of scenario, because how can you be salt and light realistically in a circumstance that does not allow you to be salt and light?
Right.
If you cannot represent the truth, but are required to represent an error under certain circumstances, how is that being salt and light or advancing the gospel even in a limited way? I don't see it personally. Mm-hmm. Now some of them say, yeah, but then if I don't stay there, then there's no Christians there. I said, well, there are essentially no Christians there anyway. That is, in the way of having a personal impact, the Christians are nullified there. Now, I guess you could say, well, I have a personal impact because when I talk to Christians, I can really, you know, give them both guns. Oh, because that now I'm being a pastor to them. But you don't have the freedom to be a pastor just to them. Because if you have to be an imam, that means you've got to advance Muslim principles.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do a good job advancing Christian principles, and then you have to put on a different hat and advance error in other circumstances. And so this is where the problem is for me, and this is the dissimilarity with the school situation. In the school situation, you're muzzled in some measure, but you're not obliged to communicate the opposite of your views. In this situation, you're not muzzled in some circumstances, but you are in other circumstances, and further, you are obliged to communicate the opposite of your views.
Mm-hmm.
This, to me, is not tenable. Let's put it this way. Here's the place where I think it's appropriate to ask, what would Jesus do? You know, Jesus, who said, all who came before me are thieves and robbers and stuff like that, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no man comes to the Father but through me. But since you're a Muslim and I'm talking to you as a Muslim, I'm just going to talk about Muhammad as being a great guy, and that's okay too. No, I don't think so. I don't think Jesus or the apostles, any of them, would have countenanced such a possibility. So I don't know if that helps. I think this puts you in a very difficult spot because of the nature of the job. If you are required to wear different hats, then you are required to be a pluralist in action when, in fact, you do not believe in pluralism.
Right.
You are to act as if all views are equally valid when, in fact, you don't believe that. What they ought to do is let an imam talk to the Muslim and a Buddhist monk or somebody else who believes in pluralism do that. But they shouldn't require that of a Christian. But to me, this is just another way where the Christian voice is being shut down because of a politically correct notion. The Christian is being required to advance pluralism. This actually is the other line in the sand that I was talking about, you know, although it's not being advanced so aggressively here. But they're just simply saying, here's our line. It's not same-sex marriage. Celebrate diversity in sexuality. Now it's celebrate diversity in religion. And you have to act as if the Great Commission is no longer an obligation to you.
Right.
Oh, that is a
whole... Well, it seems like, I mean, what drives it fundamentally, I think, is that they don't have, well, obviously they don't have the same worldview. When I see a dying patient, I see a soul that is going to go to God for judgment, and they just see a human being who's going to die, so it would just make them comfortable. They pass, and I'm thinking, well, maybe comfort is not the best thing this person needs if there's something on the other side for them.
That's right. I think you're exactly right on that. And so the thing is they're not
willing to hire a chaplain from every faith background, so they're trying to basically push all their chaplains to be kind of like a one-size-fits-all for everything.
Yeah, but it's not possible
and
in this kind
I
of
think
thing. It's just an unrealistic
requirement. The hard thing
requirement.
Is, like, in one sense, you think about it as like a spy going in undercover, but if I were to go in and say, well, I'm not going to do the imam thing, I'm not going to play, basically, I'm not going to play ball with their game. I'm going to honor God, and eventually that comes out. Then you have a really long scandal of what they call malpractice and all this kind of
stuff.
And I
understand
is it worth it? Because I can just foresee at some point it will, like, it'll come up, and it doesn't matter how many good reviews you have or how many patients.
Right. I don't think
subterfuge you to the institution.
I don't think
you're going down.
Yeah, Josh.
For one case of malpractice.
You want my opinion? I think you're on a dead end road. That's what my opinion is. You don't want to practice subterfuge in this circumstance. This wouldn't be right, and it could easily backfire, and that's what you've just said. But then, but you can't, you're not a pluralist, so you can't act like a pluralist with dying people. It's not right for them to require this of you, but you're right. There are worldview considerations going on here, and they don't believe that your view, that these people are at risk. It's just whatever. And so bring the comfort from whatever. Marx said that religion is the opiate of the people, and that is true about everything but Christianity. It is the thing that makes them feel better, even though it doesn't do them any good in the long run. It's just a, you know, it's just a kind of a fantasy drug they take. That's not true with Christianity. It's true about the other ones. These people believe it's true about every religion, and so therefore they are requiring you to march in step with their religious view, pluralism. That is not the same as yours. What if it turned out that this hospitals were, say this is in Saudi Arabia, and that you were going to be a chaplain of sorts, and what you had to do with everyone is promote Islam with every single patient? Would you do it?
No,
but why not?
Because I'd be advancing falsehood.
Okay, so how is that different in this circumstance? Now it's not every patient is a Muslim, but a bunch of patients may be Muslim. So in those circumstances, or some other religion, and in those circumstances, you're going to have to advance falsehood.
Yeah.
Maybe that will help you.
I think the dilemma for me is I have a hard time just, jumping ship and saying, well, we'll leave it to. We'll leave it to everyone else, you know.
Well, you're going to have to make the decision on this one. But
sort of handing it over to the pluralists instead of going down eventually, you know.
The pluralists
maybe
already
have an impact on some people, you know.
Josh, you're not handing it over to them. It's already theirs. They already got it. They're ruling the roost. Anybody that works for them is going to have to act like a de facto pluralist. So it isn't like you're giving some. In one sense, I see your point. Well, they were abandoned in the field, but look, that's a judgment sometimes you have to make in any spiritual battle. In any battle, you have to say you got to choose the hill you're going to die on. All right, and under these circumstances, this is my own personal view on this. I mean, I have reasons for it. I'm not relativizing it, but I'm saying this is my view. But you have to be responsible for your view, is what I'm saying. My view is that if I were put in a circumstance where I had to speak falsehood to a dying person, I wouldn't do it. I would not do it. Oh, you're going to God, Muslim. I'm wondering if you would ask the ruling authorities there, what if you were talking to a fundamentalist Muslim, a jihadist, somebody who is jihadist? Would it be appropriate for you to advance jihadist notions with the Muslim? That is, you act as his jihadist imam. That Islam is the only way, and if you kill somebody on your way out, it guarantees you heaven and 70 virgins or whatever. If that were the patient's view, would they be comfortable with you advancing that to him and encouraging them in that? I bet you they'd say, no, you can't do that.
Right.
You can't advance that view because that's an exclusivist view.
Right.
You're telling the Muslim that his religion is the only true religion. Other people are going to, and that you are encouraging him in his jihadist notions. No, you can't do that. I guarantee you they tell you that. So what they're after is not you communicating to everybody their own beliefs, my suspicion is, but rather that you are communicating in a way that is consistent with the hospital's general beliefs about religion, that is pluralism.
Right. Which basically means none of it really matters.
Well, and so whether you pull out of this or not, that's up to you. You have to make your own decision on that. But I would not pursue this. This is going to be, and this is just the way it works. this is going to mean that some Christians end up pulling out of things and leaving a spiritual vacuum there. But I don't know any other choice unless God sovereignly works to get information into a situation.
Yeah.
Because we are being forced out of things, just like closed countries. But that doesn't mean that God can't work, even though the missionaries can't get in there. And this is, by the way, a mistake we've made in the past. Oh, my goodness, they pushed all these missionaries out of China. They closed China off. This is during the revolution, the Cultural Revolution. And what ended up happening was a massive revival, indigenous revival that God accomplished. So you never know.
Mm-hmm.
All righty?
All righty. Well, thanks for your time, Greg.
Okay, I appreciate your call, Josh. It's a tough decision that you're faced with, and more of these tough decisions are coming down the pike for Christians, and it's because of the way what's happening in our culture. So we just have to all get ready for it. Thanks for your call, though, Josh. I think I missed a break here. Okay, break is up here, and I'll be back after this.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Back at you here on Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel. Place to clear your heads out. You know, I noticed something when I started doing radio that it forced me, this is 25 years ago, but it forced me to be a lot more careful, thoughtful, intentional about my own views. Since I had to explain them more clearly, I had to answer questions, challenges, etc. And this is a good thing. It just forced me to be more careful. It cleared my head out. So, okay, let's go to the Bronx and Tony. Hey, Tony, it's our buddy Tony from the Bronx, I bet you.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Doing good. Good to have you on board, Tony.
Good. Happy Tuesday.
Thank you, buddy.
I have a question. It occurred to me, the other day I had a dream where I opened a door and someone popped in and I was surprised. And I have dreams like that, you know, where you get surprised by this or something else. It could be you fall off building or something, but you're surprised. So my question is this. How is it that if I'm, in essence, the director of the dream, I'm surprised?
Right.
How do I get surprised?
Well, this is a very interesting question, and I don't know that I am fully capable answering this. I think it strikes me as fairly axiomatic, the truth of what you just said, that we are the directors of our own dreams. I remember thinking once, I mean, after a fashion, we are directors. I remember thinking, dreaming once of a friend of mine from high school that kind of entered my dream, and he had two big Great Danes that he was leading. And then I thought, I mean, I don't really know the significance or anything of it. And I woke up in the morning and I thought, who put those two dogs in my dream? Where did they come from? Why were they there, kind of thing? What was the cause
exactly.
of that? Now, I know that I think it's safe to say that our dreams are products of our own minds.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also safe to say that our minds operate on different levels, and that in reflective moments, we are aware that we do things for subconscious reasons, that are reasons that are ours in our minds, but they are not things that we're consciously aware of. When you think about it, most of the things you believe, you're not consciously aware of. To believe something doesn't mean to be holding it in conscious awareness in your mind at the time, because you can't be consciously aware of many things.
Right.
Yet when you get in your car and turn the key on while you're thinking of Pizza Hut or something, you are expressing in your actions a series of beliefs that you're committed to.
Okay.
So those beliefs are active in your own mind somewhere where you are not consciously aware of. These beliefs are called I think they're called dispositional beliefs. So things that we believe that we're not consciously aware of. And a lot of these dispositional beliefs can run our lives in ways that we don't realize it. And this is what sometimes counseling does, is it helps us to see the behaviors that we're doing and the reasons behind them, that is the beliefs that are driving them that we're not consciously aware of.
Okay.
So this is just to establish a common sense notion that our own minds, our minds that are ours, operate on different levels. There are different things going on kind of in the background, like computers.
Right.
You got background activity going on in addition to what's happening on the screen, which would be analogous to our conscious awareness.
Okay.
So since our minds are operating at different levels, and things are happening that are our activity, our mental activity, but our conscious awareness is we are not consciously aware of, I guess is what I mean. Then I think dreams happen in the same way. They're ours. We are writing the script. But the script that we write, for whatever reason, and I don't know why we write the script that we write. I think that there are probably subconscious issues that are being worked out.
Okay.
Sometimes recurrent dreams are signals to something that we're struggling with.
I
recurrent dream that makes a lot of sense to me when I think of other things in my life. We're writing that script, but on a conscious level, and here I'm using the word conscious a little bit differently because we're in our dreams.
Mm-hmm.
We have a dream consciousness, that is the awake feeling in the dream that we're aware of things happening, and then we have our subconscious, which is writing the script, and we're not aware of even in our dream.
Got it.
Okay,
yeah, that
and
makes sense.
Because we're not aware of it,
mm-hmm.
we are surprised in our dreams. And so here comes my high school buddy with these two dogs. Where did you come from? You know, and so we can be surprised. We can be shocked. We can be frightened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A whole host of emotions can be part of our dreams, even though we're creating the script. I would say most of the time, and this would be almost universally the case. Now, there are times when I think that God gives us dreams, and these are revelatory in nature, and I think that there are times, I don't know I've ever had anything like that. I think it could be that there are demonic elements that might cause certain elements of dreams. That I'm open to that, the invasion of our minds in some ways. It seems to be possible Satan placed it upon Judas's heart, or put it in his mind to betray Christ, right? So
yeah,
we know that there's a something like that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm open to Satan putting thoughts in our mind. And I think this is where, you know, certain types of temptation seems to be examples of that. So I don't know why he can't put thoughts into our dreams or sequences in our dreams somehow. I don't know how that works, but it seems possible. So when it comes to that, you know, I personally like my dreams, you know.
Me, I'm down with you. I love them.
Yeah, you kind of go to dreamland, you know.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place. It can be, you know.
Yeah, well, it can be. Sometimes it can be frightening. But have you noticed, though, that sometimes you're an observer of your dreams and sometimes you're a participant?
Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes you just long for the ride and you're watching things happen. Even your own activities you're watching happen. So yourself in the dreams, you're not thinking about doing that. You're just watching yourself go through these scripts. But there are times when you can kind of direct the script consciously. Mm-hmm. I know that there have been times when I've said, oh, hey, I'm in this situation. I can will to do this in the dream I'm having now. And there's been times when I've even willed myself out of a dream that I didn't like.
Okay. Wow.
In fact, I'm thinking of a couple of occasions now where there's some bad guys in my dream, and they're after me, and I'm trying to fight against these bad guys. Uh-huh. And so what I think in my dream is I think I'm just going to wake up and disappear. That is, these guys are going to hold me now, and they got me in there, and I'm just going to disappear. I'm going to go from the dream world into the actual world, and I'm going to disappear from the. And they're going to be like the guy on the It's a Wonderful Life, you know, the cop and the taxi guy who grabbed the angel and he disappears.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of the picture I have in my mind of these guys. Yeah, they got me now, but I'm going to poof out. They're going to be looking, where did he go? Where did he go? I need a drink, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, dreams are odd and unusual, and some people get really into them, but I think that's
okay. Oh, that was great. Thanks.
To think
I
of
appreciate
it.
That.
All right, Tony, say hi to your brother for us, okay?
I sure will.
All right, thanks. Take care. Thank you for the call. Well, what a fascinating topic, though, and some people say they never dream. I think they dream, but they don't remember their dreams. You're supposed to be dreaming when you're almost awake. You have those REMs, those rapid eye movements. So I notice that I have my most vivid dreams and most fun ones for some reason. If I wake up in the morning and I get a chance to sleep in, so I go back to sleep, and then it's going to be a shallow sleep. And I have all kinds of fun escapades there early on before the rest of my, until I wake up, you know, and then I'm in the real world. But anyway, that's it for this hour, friends. One more hour to go. Hope you stay with me on Stand to Reason. The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters in many cases. I got faulted for saying ladies and gentlemen to an audience of Christians once, not too long ago, actually, and actually it was a fair point. Well, if you're in a church, why don't you say brothers and sisters instead of ladies and gentlemen? I said, well, that's more family, right? Okay. But I realize that my radio show is a huge variety, and I want to acknowledge the presence of those who don't share my views. So it's, I guess it's friends. Maybe that covers all the bases. How about that? All right. The show is Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel, your host. This is our final hour of three. And if you only get one of the three, then you need to get all of the three, and you can get that by podcasting. You can go to str.org in order to get the podcast. You can go to iTunes and look up Stand to Reason. You can get it that way, but it's free. It's 3 hours a week, and maybe the best I want to be careful. It may be the best education in thinking critically about critical issues that you're going to get all week. How about that? That's probably safe. Maybe. Okay. For some people, this is the only education you're getting on it, and this is my goal here on the show, not just to tell you what to think, but to teach you how to think as much as I can. Okay, with that as a predicate here for our 1 hour, our final hour, let's just go right to the callers. Bruce in Iowa. Is that a five? It is a five. Okay. Bruce in Iowa, welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thanks, Greg. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, I'll just plunge right in here. I have a brother. I'm 54. He's a little bit younger, 48, 49. He's got a couple kids, and one of them is a young lady who is becoming, by her definition, a young man.
Mm-hmm.
She would be 21, 22 years old, goes to a very liberal arts school. Now, I haven't brought up this topic before because I'm not looking to, you know, mm-hmm. that's kind of a tender subject. We've talked about other things. I've tried to make the case for the Christian worldview. We've mm-hmm. talked about abortion, that kind of stuff. And he also has a son who is 17. And the son actually had Facebook message me just right around Thanksgiving, said, hey, I'd like to talk to you about how you view transsexual.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay. And Mike, actually, my brother actually reached out to me and said, hey, you know, kind of be careful. And I said, I will. I'm not going to, you know, start any fires here. So we had a nice chat. The brother, the youngest one, my brother, and the daughter, who, like I said, has undergone hormone treatment already and mm-hmm. is, over the Christmas break, going to have a double mastectomy.
My goodness.
And I kind of want to make sure that I was on the right track for this discussion throughout. I wasn't taking a position, this is good, bad, or indifferent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have an opinion, obviously, but I, you know, there's no sense in getting everybody too wound up, so mm-hmm. I was pretty careful with my words, and I try to start the discussion out the way I always do, by establishing that we agree that objective truth exists mm-hmm. and is knowable.
Mm-hmm.
I want to run like four things by you quick, and then you just bounce back at me and say, yeah, I think you're on the right track there, Bruce, or here's a better way you could have done that, or that kind of thing. Will that work?
For me, yeah, that'll work fine.
Hey, Greg?
Yeah. I heard you. That'll work. Bruce, are you still
Greg?
There? Oh, gosh. What is up with this? I'm here, Bruce. I hear you fine. But apparently...
Hey, Greg?
Yeah. It's two calls, one show. We got this same thing. Okay, Bruce. Oh, we must have lost him now. So I don't know what to do here. It looks like we lost Bruce. We've got an open line, so if he tries to call back...
Greg?
Yeah, maybe we're going to get a better... Bruce, we don't have a good connection here. Bruce. Okay, I'm going to drop Bruce, and Bruce can call back if you can hear
me.
Hey,
Greg, I'm here.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
What is happening?
It wasn't me.
Okay, I didn't touch any buttons or anything, so I don't know what's going on. Let's just rebuke the devil and move forward. Okay. Now, in this circumstance, if I would have dropped you, you could always call right back and probably got picked up right in the same line. We would have brought you right ahead. But my response to your question was, that's fine with me for you to pursue that type of conversation with me.
Okay, so I'll rattle off. The first thing I always bring up is objective truth exists and is knowable, and I use J.P. Moreland does the trick of putting a pen on a podium. It says, depends on the podium, reality shows, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I had my
why do you call it a J.P. Moreland thing?
I saw him do it.
You saw J.P. Moreland do that?
Well, not in person, but he does that on the to demonstrate the existence of objective truth.
No, I understand that. That's, I thought that's my trick, though, and I thought I thought that up.
Well,
but maybe he got it from me.
Maybe he stole it from you. I don't know.
I'm going to have to talk to him about that. Okay.
I saw him do it on a YouTube video, and I thought, oh, that's perfect.
Oh, well, that's great. Anyway,
I had the iPad. I put the iPad on the table.
Got it.
Okay, so that was my first thing, and my nephew and my brother said, oh, yeah, of course, that's perfectly obvious. So we kind of proceeded from there.
Uh-huh.
The niece, like I said, who's transitioning, got involved a little bit later. The one of the things the niece brought up was words don't mean the same thing to everybody. Now, my response to this was, well, hey, then there's no value in having any communication with anyone ever.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's true that words have slight differences, but if you have a common cultural background, you're speaking the same language, there's no reason you can't have an intelligent conversation.
Okay, well, let me jump in.
Yeah, go.
Okay, I would not have responded that way. I would have just said you're right, because it is the case that word taken just simply straightforward, her statement, it's true. And so I want to see where she's going to go with that. And words don't have the same meaning for everybody. Well, that's, yeah, okay. Who would argue with that? Now, your concern is where she's going to go with that, and I would have let her go and then take an exception maybe further down the line.
Okay.
Okay, just to see. Because now she's going to might say, well, what you think is gender, I don't think is gender. What you think is female isn't female. And then we can talk about particulars instead of being lost in generalities. But so that's just my piece of advice at that particular point. Tell me how it continued, though, because maybe
this
will...
I like that. That makes sense. I should have done more of the, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, but it's an understandable, I'm not faulting you for it. I'm just giving you feedback, okay? All right, so what happened next? Did we lose you again?
Hey, Greg.
Okay, Bruce. Okay, Bruce.
Hey, Greg.
Yeah, gotcha. Bruce. Oh, this is... Bruce.
Greg?
Yeah. Good night.
Hey, Greg?
Yeah. Yep. I'm here. It's me, Bruce. Okay. Maybe we should mention to Tom that we had this problem. I don't know what the deal is, but Bruce?
Greg, are you still there?
I'm still here. I haven't moved. Bruce, why don't you call back? I'm going to pick up another caller.
Hey, Greg?
Yeah. Yeah, Bruce.
I think it's on your end.
Well, I don't know. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're back.
Okay,
again.
I have no idea. Have not the foggiest. Nobody's touched anything here. Nothing. So
me either.
I don't know. We're gonna have our tech take a look at that later. He's not here right now. So, but anyway, let's,
okay.
So then the next thing.
Your reality versus my reality. My reality is different than your reality. Blah blah blah. Which of course is true. And I always make this point. Yes, we could all be in the Matrix, but we look both ways before we cross the street.
Yeah, well, this is what. Yeah, I think you might have asked for, what do you mean by my reality versus your reality? And I think what they mean is my beliefs versus your beliefs. The word reality. Well, then, can you have false beliefs? Yes, in principle. Yes. Well, then it's not reality, is it? So I think the language, my reality versus your reality, I'm going to try to get that off the table because it's really confusing. Because that's relativizing the conversation.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Good. Mm-hmm. I love that. I will pursue that. I'm doing this kind of. I wrote them a response back that night. I wasn't quite as quick-witted, but
I wrote
a two-page response. That here's things that I see that will prevent any productive discussion from being had if we can't come someplace close on this.
Sure.
And then, of course, objective morality. Because all throughout the night she's saying my beliefs and the people that I associate with, if we act on our beliefs, they're harmful to her. So I just right away said, well, do you think objective morality exists? And she said, no.
Well, then what's the wrong with harming
her?
I don't
understand how you can have it both ways. It seems to me that you're wanting to have your cake and eat it too.
Right. I think that's a fair challenge. I'm not exactly sure presumably she is talking about your views are harming her. Now, she is the one that is planning to have somebody cut off important parts of her body. All right? So how is it that your views are harming her when your views are meant... Did I lose you again?
One of us, I think you, but who knows, the sound is giving problems. So it's probably rude to the rest of your listeners for me to continue.
Okay.
So I'm going to hang. Oh, there I am again.
Okay, but you know, this is a good point. Go ahead.
I think I should probably I'm losing you again sound wise. So I think I will probably hang up and listen to you on the radio.
Okay.
Or I'll catch you on the podcast.
Okay, sounds good, Bruce. Thank you so much for your kindness on that one. But I'll just finish my response to this last point that you made, and this is something that I'm not surprised to hear. That the person who has this point of view, this belief about themselves, transgender. I'm trying to find a word that is not condescending, but it also is not inappropriately supportive. So that's why I'm pausing on this. But the person who believes that they're a different gender than their body, okay, if this is the standard pushback. If you don't approve of my view, you're hurting me. This kind of thing comes down all the time, and I'm asking, well, how am I hurting you? Well, because now I feel bad. Well, her response presumes that she shouldn't feel bad about her circumstances. I think that the circumstances indicate something's wrong. And I think she thinks something's wrong, which is why she wants to have parts of her body removed. Something is wrong. And she's trying to make her physical body right, presuming that her mental perspective is the correct one and her body's wrong. I just simply want to say, I don't think your body's wrong. I think your body's right. I think your mental perspective is wrong, and that you would be doing a greater harm to yourself by having an operation instead of getting some counseling that will help you to have your mental perspective match your body. Incidentally, there is no such thing, and I've said this many times, but I'll keep saying it, there is no such thing as a sex change operation. Did you notice the comment Bruce was making? She's already undergoing what? Hormone treatments? Because her body is screaming one thing and will continue to do it the rest of her life. It's screaming a gender because every cell in her body is gendered. Every single cell in her body is gendered. By cutting off pieces of the body doesn't change the gender. It just mutilates the body. There is no such thing as a sex change operation. You cannot change your sex. Now, people who think they can are fooling themselves. They can change their body to more conform with their mental ideas, but they ultimately, in terms of its looks, clothing and all of that, but ultimately they don't change their sex. It's immutable. It's part of that is genuinely and irrefutably part of who you are. It's in every cell of your body. So the charge that the person who objects is the one that's doing the harm is not going to be persuasive to me. And it shouldn't be, no one else should be persuaded by that or bullied by it, because I think this is what this is. You're being mean to me because you don't agree with my view. You're being mean to me. And so when people say that, the rest of the crowd doesn't want anybody to feel like they're being mean to anybody else. So let's just go along with them and give them what they want, even if it's really not good for them. The irony is they don't mind being mean to other people who disagree. Like presumably Bruce. They don't mind being mean to him. Now, he didn't get into discussion about how he's being treated in this, but I know how this is often played out. The other side has full justification in their own mind to be completely obscene in some cases towards those who disagree. They have no patience, no tolerance, no kindness, no nothing like that. Not every time, but much of the time. So, okay, Jacob, Bruce, thank you for the call. I'm just looking at the clock. Let's quickly go to break early, and then we'll give more time to the rest of the callers. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason's the show. Stay with us.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians, just like you, will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
All right, friends, back at you here. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. All right, let's go to Maryland and Terrence. Maryland, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? This is Terrence.
Yeah,
how are you?
Okay. Good to talk to you, Terrence.
Thank you. Thank you. And I want to say that I was introduced to your program in 2007. I did an internship in Pittsburgh. Uh-huh. I was a grad student at Penn State University, and I did an internship in Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh.
And I think hearing about your program just on the radio through the Hank Hanegraaff show was probably the most I got out of that internship. You know, it's completely changed the trajectory of my spiritual life.
Wow.
And I consider you to be my spiritual mentor.
Wow.
So
thank you. I've said recently, I think in a video that's going online, I said it was a Thanksgiving video. The thing that I'm most thankful for is when people say, I consider you a mentor, even people who I'd never met before like you, Terrence. So that's, you touched my heart. Thank you.
Thank you. Since then, I've gotten into street evangelism,
mm-hmm.
and so I've kind of been doing that for about the past year.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it pretty interesting. You know, before I started getting into it, I thought that people didn't really want to talk about religion. And then I started doing it, and I find that some people don't mind.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's been a pleasant experience, and I've been using the tactics approach and things like that. And I also find that it helps me in my personal life.
Uh-huh.
It's really easy to now evangelize to coworkers because I'm already wound up. I know what the gospel is. I'm very clear on that sort of thing.
And to
friends and that sort of thing.
Sure, well, that's great.
But I've been picking up a lot of evangelistic literature and just reading about it. And the impression that I get from the literature is that the purpose of life is to evangelize. In fact, you know, I think I read one author that said that, you know, basically the reason why you're still here on earth is to share the gospel.
Yeah.
But then I remember hearing you a few weeks ago talk about the Westminster Confession, and you talked about the end of man,
mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing.
Yeah, the chief end of man is to know God and glorify him forever, I think is the way it's put there in the Westminster Confession, right?
Okay, and so, but I've been thinking about the purpose of life, and you know, why we're still here. What's my purpose? What am I doing? That sort of thing. And I've been trying to find scriptural evidence for that. And I just wanted to know if you knew some things off the top of your head.
Well, I have some thoughts on this, and I actually am a bit frustrated with the reductionist claim that the only reason we're still here on earth is to evangelize. I do not understand how people can draw that conclusion, okay? Because certainly communicating the gospel, fulfilling the Great Commission is the central responsibility of the church, okay? Mm-hmm. However, having said that, it isn't the only reason that we're on, that any individual is on the earth. There are lots of different things that are important that we are to pursue. And the question first came to I'm seeing it on Melinda's card. It says, "What Bible verse gives the purpose of life?" So you've characterized it a little differently. You've asked it in a more expansive way. But I'll tell you the verse that I thought of, though I think if the question were put just this way, I think it's misstated, because it isn't as if you're going to find the purpose of life in an individual verse necessarily. Okay. The verses didn't come in until 500, 400 years ago or something like that. And so it may be that the purpose of life is communicated in a more general fashion throughout the text and throughout the narrative. But the one that, if I had to pick a verse, it would be in John 17, verse 3. This is Jesus praying his prayer for the disciples at the end of the Last Supper before he's about to be betrayed. And he says in verse 3, "This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent." I can't think of any other place in the Bible that captures the essence of it so crisply. The purpose of life is to know God. Now, it doesn't use the word purpose there. It uses the phrase eternal life. But I think this is expressing the purpose. When God made the world, he made man to be co-regent, in a sense, on the earth, but also to be obviously in relationship with him. And that's why he's made in God's image. Man is made in God's image so that he can share this friendship for which he was created. There's a lot of other purposes. I think work is a purpose of life. God placed man on the earth to accomplish a task. Work is not a result of the fall. The toil of work is a result of the fall, but not work itself. Work comes before the fall. And so that we are the kind of creatures who flourish in the midst of doing meaningful activity, I think, is something that God intends. And I think this will continue even in the afterlife, that we will be engaged in meaningful activity. So there is just one other example of one of the reasons we were created. We are created to be in relationship with God, eternal life, to know the true God through Jesus. We were created to do meaningful work, to participate with God in all kinds of purposes. So these are things that here's another thing in terms of life. When people say, "Well, evangelism is the main reason we're here," why else would we be here? For the formation of our souls. That's what else. For the formation of our souls, that is, God intends to use this life to form our souls in a particular way. In 1 Timothy, I think, Paul writes to Timothy that physical exercise is of little profit, but godliness is a means of great gain, for it holds a promise not only for this life, but also for the life to come. Well, godliness is something we're not just given when we become Christians. A godliness is something we develop throughout life, really in the midst of difficulty and trial and hardship. "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, that you be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." So there's a teleology for men's souls that God has in view, that he's going to use the trials and difficulties of our lives to make us more like Jesus. And this particular fact comes out in Romans 8. We know that God causes all things to work together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he predestined to become conformed to the image of his son. Now, this is not a verse that I like right at the moment. The reason is because conforming to the Son comes as a result of trial and difficulty. And so when we're in the midst of the trial and difficulty, it's not fun, okay? But this is what God has purposed. the Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 talks about the affliction that we experience produces an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. This is verse 17, so of 2 Corinthians 4. So I'm just tossing these verses out and kind of running through these passages to hopefully make it clear that it is not true that the only reason that we're on the earth is for evangelism, that the purpose of our life is evangelism. I do not think the purpose of our life is evangelism. I think the purpose of our earthly lives is that we become more like Jesus, that we develop in godliness. That's what I think this life is for. And evangelism is certainly part of our responsibility while we're here. But there is growth that happens in this life that will not be possible, it seems, in heaven. This life, the place where evil is present, is the life where God is using the evil to work for good. You can't use evil to work for good in heaven, right? So I'm just completely opposed to the notion that the only reason or even the major reason that we're here is for evangelism. It strikes me that there are a lot of other passages that indicate otherwise. In fact, I can't think of, any passage that indicates that the reason we're here is for evangelism. I can't even think of a single verse off the top of my head that implies that. Now, I know that 2 Peter says that the reason Jesus hasn't come yet is not because he's slow, but because he's long-suffering, not wanting others to perish. So God's waiting, in some sense, because of those who will come to him. But it doesn't say that, you know, our whole goal in life is to evangelize. I don't, and I think people who say that just have a truncated understanding of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're, so there you go, Terrence.
Okay, can I say one more thing? I guess ask a small follow-on question really quickly.
Okay, real quickly. We've got some other people on the line, but let me grab this one.
Okay. So what about, like, the book of Acts? You know, you look at the book of Acts and you see that it's, you know, this narrative about Paul and a lot of these guys going out and sharing the gospel.
Right.
Like, how would you what would you say about
that?
Well,
that is a characterization of the fulfillment of a command that Jesus gave there in the beginning of the book of Acts, that the gospel would go out to Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the world. This identifies a major role of Christians is to fulfill. Well, this is just an exemplification of the Great Commission that's given right at the same time, though it's recorded there at the end of Matthew. It's given at the same time that the Acts 1 passage covers. So this is a manifestation of obedience to the Great Commission. It is not, I don't think it is meant to communicate that the only purpose we are alive is to take the gospel. And this is why when we go to these other passages, we see that there are lots of other things that are going on here. That relate to God using this life to accomplish another end. So when I said I don't know of a verse that affirms the idea that there are verses that affirm evangelism, Great Commission, and exemplify it. Look in the Book of Acts. I don't know of verses that imply that evangelism is the main reason or the only reason we left here on Earth, and the reason we haven't had our own private raptures. If we would have had our private rapture when we became regenerate, we would all enter eternity as spiritual babes. Do you ever think of that? We'd enter eternity as spiritual babies. Now, people who become Christians at the end of life, that's the way they enter eternity, you know, as spiritual babies in their diapers. And I don't know that they ever get out, because it seems that godliness is to be developed in this environment, not in that environment. There's a resurrection. There's a transformation, clearly. But there's the virtues that can only be developed here. Anyway, there's something to chew on, okay?
Thank you so much.
All right, Terrence, it's a pleasure talking with you. Bye-bye now. Let's go to JJ in Maine. Get the right button here. JJ, welcome.
Hello, Mr. Kokel.
Hello, sir.
How are you doing today?
Okay, I'm doing fine. Glad to talk to you.
Yep. I just want to, like, thank you for something. I started listening to you when about 5 years ago. I got a little iPod Shuffle.
Oh, my goodness, Jay. You know what? I didn't recognize you at first because you have grown up a lot, and it's in your voice, for goodness sake. You sound like a young man now.
Yeah, I'm 15 now.
Well, good for you. You are a young man. Good for you.
Yeah, thank you.
That's fabulous.
And our website has also helped us talk to Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh, good.
You know, the articles on there.
Yeah, yeah. That's great.
So well, I just wanted to thank you for those articles.
You're welcome. And by the way, are you the younger of the two brothers or the
No,
younger?
I'm the older one.
Okay, and your younger brother is?
Josh.
Hey, you know what? I'm looking at you right now. I'm right here. I've got your Christmas card. Let me just take my glasses off so I can see it better. The Blackmans, 2013. That's you, right?
Yeah.
Well, there you got, and you're probably the tall one of the group.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a whole bunch of you. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
Six.
Oh, so there's seven total. There they are, seven beaming faces coming from the Christmas blessings card. That's great. You know, I put it here so I can make reference to it next time you called, and that was in 2013, and now it's a year later, and you're calling in, and I had it there so long, it just kind of faded into the background, and I forgot. It was there until now we're talking. Oh, my gosh, there you are. All right. Well, it's great to talk to you, JJ.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, too.
Thanks.
So I want to just give a little background on my question first.
Okay.
It's, you know, we've been talking to Mormons at the door and on the Mormon chat that they have on their website, Mormon.org.
Right.
And, you know, my dad and brother, we've and I have been trying, you know, defending Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And about how Jesus is God and the salvation and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple weeks or a month ago or something like that, my dad was reading in Family Worship, 2 Timothy 2:14. It says not to quarrel with non-believers or the false teachers, or not to quarrel about words. And I was wondering, if on one hand God tells us to witness to people, you know, the Great Commission, but and this verse seems to say not to quarrel. So where's the line? I mean, is it worth the time we're taking to do the chats and to talk to them on a doorstep? And then Matthew 7:6 also comes into it, not throwing your pearls before swine.
Yeah. Okay, let me offer you some thoughts that might be helpful. It's the end of chapter. I have the verse here, verse 14 of 2 Timothy 2. Remind them of these things and solemnly charge them in the presence of God not to wrangle about words, which is useless and leads to the ruin of hearers. Then there in verse 23 of that chapter says, refuse foolish and ignorant speculations, knowing they produce quarrels, but the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but kind, able to teach, patient when wronged, with gentleness correcting. Okay, so there's a couple of things here. Let's just stay in the end of chapter 2 of Timothy here, where it says, don't be quarrelsome. Okay, if we're not to be quarrelsome, what are we to be? Well, we are to be kind to all, able to teach, patient when wrong, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition. The emphasis here is the way we engage people, not the content of what we say. Paul's telling us to correct. So correcting oftentimes requires being precise about particulars. Nothing wrong with that. And in fact, Paul is pretty precise about particulars in a lot of his writings. What he doesn't want us to be doing is getting into a quarrelsome mode where we're just having spats with people that are not productive. Rather, we should be patient and then patient when wrong, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition, if perhaps God may grant them repentance, leading to the knowledge of the truth. It's interesting there in the second chapter, verse 14, when he says not to wrangle about words, the next verse says, be diligent to present yourself approved to God as a workman who does not need to be ashamed, handling accurately the word of truth, but avoid worldly and empty chatter, for it will lead to further ungodliness. So taken as a whole, I don't think this is teaching that we shouldn't get into, you know, in a certain sense, theologically competitive discussions with people. We are not to be caught up in silliness silly little wrangling about inconsequentials. We're to be good students of the Word and understand the Word clearly, and then when we engage people who differ, we're not to be quarrelsome, but rather with gentleness correcting them with the truth. So if you are having productive and fruitful, I should say civil, conversations with Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses about things that actually matter, then I don't think you are violating these passages.
Okay.
I know that Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe in Christmas or in giving blood or a number of things for theological reasons. I think it would be a waste of time talking about that. Because even if they change their mind about Christmas and blood giving or receiving, that wouldn't move them any closer to truth that really matters here. It's the person and work of Christ that matters. And that's okay. What you got to focus in on. And the same thing with the LDS beliefs or any other group that is not reflecting classical Christian theology, but is a contender for the word Christian with alternate theology.
Okay, so you're talking about things like if we we disagreed on old Earth, young Earth. You mean talking about that wouldn't be like the best thing?
Well, I think
it's
okay.
Saying
to...
if they were young Earth. Just using that as an example.
Okay, I think that is an issue that should be discussed.
Okay,
but that's one that can get into that can shed a lot more heat than light. And where people end up arguing about it with the kind of intensity that divides Christians, and the division of Christians is more of a problem than the issue they're talking about there. Notice, okay. He says, do not wrangle about words. You know, sometimes the words really matter. I think he's talking about fussing over things that do not matter. That's what I think he's in view there. And then in your Matthew passage, I think the age of the earth is a legitimate discussion, but it sometimes turns into an unhelpful fight. And this, I have no interest in pursuing that. So in the Matthew passage, do not give what is holy to dogs. Do not throw your pearls before swine. And then what's interesting is the next phrase. And you know the rule, it's stand to reason. Never what?
Read a Bible verse.
Yeah, there you go. So let's read some more and see what this might help. Lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. So my application of this is that if you're having a productive conversation with people that are not believers, they're not swine. They're not dogs. Jesus, I think, is talking about a certain type of person that is dishonoring the things that you're saying in a vicious way. And if you're talking to somebody and it looks like they're about to trample trampling what you say underfoot, and they are going to turn and try to tear you to pieces, that's probably best to abandon the conversation.
Okay, so maybe a steamroller, the aggressive kind, would
yes,
fit in this category.
Exactly. In fact, that's where I use this verse. So if you've got your tactics book, look up the steamroller chapter, and you'll find this verse in there.
Yeah, this is fresh in my mind because I'm going through the ambassador basic curriculum
right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just finished the ambassador one. Yeah. I mean, the first 5 hours or whatever.
Good for you. The A. The A of the ABCs. Okay.
Yes, that's what I meant.
Good for you. Well, does this bring any more light on these passages for you and your family?
Yes, I think it does. So I'm understanding you correctly when I say you can argue civilly about the key issues, but don't just argue about the very trivial things.
Yeah, I would.
And be civil.
Yes, be civil in all circumstances, and if you're not civil, even on the important things, then you're breaching the directive here in 2 Timothy chapter 2 towards the end, with gentleness correcting. That's what we should be doing, okay? And we can talk about a full range of stuff, but what we don't want to do is quibble about things that don't ultimately matter, because this creates hostility between people, sometimes between brothers and sisters in Christ. And even if they're not a brother or sister, if we're quibbling about things that don't really matter, we're wasting our energies, and we're majoring in the minors, and even if we persuade them, it doesn't do any good. It's not relevant. It's not important. stick with the most important things, and then if a person who's a critic becomes a follower of Christ, the Holy Spirit ends up cleaning up a bunch of that other stuff all on its own, you know. Make sense?
Yes, it does.
JJ, say hi to your family for me, okay?
Okay, I will.
And let them know I got last year's Christmas card right in front of me.
Okay.
So I look forward to this year's. See how you've grown.
Yep. Thank you very much.
All right, all the best to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. What a great call. Oh, super. I'm looking at the clock. I'm also looking at the caller. So we're just going to skip this break and keep moving, all right? Let's go to Justin in New York. Justin, welcome, sir.
Hi, Greg.
Hi.
Well, I'll jump right in since you have other callers.
Okay.
I heard you recently answer a question for a law enforcement officer who had asked something about having to arrest fellow Christians if there were some kind of edict put out and Christians were conscientious objectors.
Mm-hmm. Like, for example, same-sex marriage or whatever, and if it came to the point that some were going to be arrested under that, yeah.
Yeah, it was the Houston thing.
Yeah, that was what's precipitated it, correct.
Yeah, so you took that call. And you, if you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember you answering the question that basically, as a law enforcement officer, he should err on the side of arresting and allow the system to work it out.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothered me, but I think I wanted to give you an opportunity maybe to clarify.
Yeah.
Because there could be situations, and there are today in America, where arresting somebody could lead to a very traumatic and unjust experience, like the young girl that was taken away from her family in Massachusetts earlier this year, Justina Pelletier. And only after a raft of media attention did the Massachusetts Department of Family let her go. Just as an example, like, shouldn't it be that if law enforcement officers who are Christians have any question about the just treatment of a subject that especially would be another Christian, that they should err on the side of protecting their constitutional liberties before they put them in the hands of a possibly dangerous situation with the law?
Okay, let me respond to that. And just to let you know, this created a little dissension here at our office, those comments. So I understand the concern there. And I think there comes a point when it's clear that fulfilling one's duties to the law is a breach of a higher moral obligation. I don't know that that is obviously clear in the illustrations that have been given, though, and a lot of times, I mean, in fact, in order to be able to make that judgment, one has to be in possession of quite a bit of information that maybe they're not in possession of. And this is my concern. You know, if a police officer is going to be, and I want to be careful I say this, but really function as judge and jury in any situation. They're being sent in there to do a job, and it doesn't seem right to them. This doesn't satisfy me that they are justified in not acting. Because it may not seem right to them because they're not in possession of relevant facts that would change their judgment if they were. A judge and a jury are in a better position to get that information. Now, I think there are limits to this, and these are going to be judgment calls. And there is this, I think, going to be a gray area, you know, a no man's land where it's hard to figure out what the right thing to do is. What I think it's going to be, more harm will result if police officers then are kind of willy-nilly drawing their conclusions based on their conscience and what they see as to whether they're going to arrest a person or not or carry out this responsibility. Right now in America, we have a very healthy due process. And matter of fact, some people would say it's too healthy. That is, there's too much process due. So with that in mind, I think that the one should err on the side of the law. One shouldn't err if he thinks he's going to err. Okay, if he really if there really is an error. But the point is if you're uncertain, the rule of law is still intact. Now, in the Third Reich, the rule of law was, well, it was intact in a certain sense, but it wasn't law. It was unjust law. And so if a person has to follow orders and arrest Jews and commit them to concentration camps in which they are destined to die, well, I think that changes things. But that isn't the situation we're facing here. So there's my clarification. I acknowledge the fact that there's a judgment element here, and that there's a broad area of where it is difficult to make the call. On some here, it seems like really obvious to go one direction. On another extreme, it's obvious to go the other. But in the middle, especially, you know, with these circumstances that we're facing right now, we don't have a lot to go by. And until the rule of law is such an important thing that stabilizes the fabric of society and intended by God to mitigate the impact of evil, that if we work to undermine the rule of law, chances are we are going to bring more evil upon people than less. And so this is why I'm leaning in that direction with the kinds of things we're talking about now. You know, things get worse, and I might land in the other direction. But I'll tell you one thing. If you're a police officer who refuses to do your duty as the state sees fit for that reason, then that's the last opportunity you'll have for peaceful resistance or whatever. You know,
certainly. And there would be an opportunity there, maybe, you know, if it came down to civil disobedience and a police officer did refuse to arrest, that may be an opportunity, if done correctly, to awaken other officers and to give a Christian witness.
Yeah,
you know,
possibly if the judgment is sound on this one. But this is, it also can be an opportunity for more mischief. So that's why I'm reluctant to kind of give a green light at this point to that, at least the way it's been expressed. But like I said, we have other voices even here at Stand to Reason that have raised the same concern that you have.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to admit that this is a tough call, and it's going to be an individual matter here, okay?
Yeah. And Greg, could I make a very brief comment before I hang up?
You may.
You'll recall Adam called twice the unbeliever who's very well articulated in the faith.
Right.
And just regarding that, what just struck me as he was speaking was the Jonathan Edwards personal narrative. It's about a 20-page testimony that Jonathan Edwards gives, where he discusses how he had a very rational grip on the facts of the faith and of God's sovereignty, mm-hmm. much like Adam sounds like he does,
mm-hmm.
and how he switched from having a bare intellectual assent to the rationalism to having a full-blown heart attachment to these truths, mm-hmm. and how it really absolutely flipped his world. And I would just, if Adam's listening, I would recommend looking up Jonathan Edwards' personal mm-hmm. narrative and really pondering that heart that goes along with the mm-hmm. intellectual aspect of Christianity.
Well, I think that's a great recommendation. This is precisely the thing. This is precisely the thing that he said that he was missing. So maybe Adam will take you up on the recommendation. Justin, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Greg in Missouri. Greg, you're on board. Hey.
Hello, Greg. It's good
Hello,
to
Greg.
Talk to you again.
Yes, nice to talk with you. Thanks.
First of all, I want to say I'd like to pick your brain if I ever need a transplant.
I haven't heard it put that way before, so I'll let it slide.
I thought I'd get a little rise on
uh-huh.
you.
That was good.
Also, you might find this interesting, too. I'm a mail carrier, and every day I go to a street called Square Circle.
No kidding.
No kidding.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. There is such a thing as a square circle.
Yeah, well, there is.
Well,
actually,
we can say that. Of course, now a lot depends on definitions, but now,
exactly.
Okay, I got to remember that. It's a street called Square Circle.
We also have a street called Kangaroo Court.
Kangaroo Court?
Yeah.
Oh, huh. Well, that doesn't create, it's not quite as interesting as the other one. I'm thinking
right.
You could have a no street street.
Yeah.
So this is like no street street. S-T, you know. Okay, got it.
Okay.
What do you got for you today?
Well, I was kind of curious where you might give some guidelines about evaluating mysticism. I know Dallas Willard was asked about what is mysticism, and he said going to heaven before you die.
Huh.
And I heard him say that. And I was thinking you have people, it's either all or nothing is the opinion most of the time, but where would you evaluate when people are kind of crossing the line?
Well, to me, the whole issue, and that's a clever statement by Dallas. Of course, now he's in heaven, but and I think it's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek treatment. It's meant to be an affective statement, not a real definition. You know, it's kind of like you're experiencing something of heaven here on earth. I get it. But how would you do that? There are lots of different ways that might be experienced. Dallas is well known for promoting the idea that everyone can hear God and they can have what he called a conversational relationship with God. And he was the mentor of J.P. Moreland. J.P. took his PhD under Dallas, and they were dear, close friends for many, many, many years. And this is a view that J.P., my mentor, holds as well. Now, I think that these kinds of questions have to be answered based on biblical revelation, by a biblical standard. And this is where I think my own view has been misunderstood, but I can understand how it'd be misunderstood, because I think that Dallas is mistaken on the particular claim that he's making, that everyone can experience a conversational relationship with God. And the implication there is that part of being a Christian entails the mystical element, i.e., specifically in this case, that we all can receive private revelation. And there's different ways this can be characterized, but I think Dallas's conversational relationship with God characterization really captures my concern, because there are lots of different ways God may, quote unquote, communicate with us. The Holy Spirit convicts us of sin. Okay, so we have an awareness that we're doing something wrong because a subjective thing is happening in our souls that God is responsible for, and we call it conviction of sin. So that this should not be controversial. It's not, in my view. But it strikes me, so there are lots of things the Holy Spirit might do that people might label as God speaking to us, but I don't use that language because I think the notion of God speaking to us is, we ought to be more precise about our language. And this is why I think that Dallas's conversational relationship with God is helpful, because there's very little ambiguity about what he has in mind. He actually thinks that we can talk to God, and then God communicates somewhat propositionally directly back to us. We could write it in sentences what we think God is saying to us. Now, when I use the word saying, I don't necessarily mean that his words are ringing in the room, and if somebody were standing next to you, he'd be able to hear the same words. It might be words in your head. It might be a sense that is crystal clear, you know, that God is giving you. That is the nature of the communication. The what's called the phenomenology of it may differ. I'm not after that. Regardless of the phenomenology, the notion that messages that are clear, crisp, propositional, ergo the term conversational from Dallas, those messages are something that every Christian, I'm wondering if has a right to expect is the right way to put it, but something in that area, that this is something available to every Christian if they are willing to attend properly, like listen properly, and if they develop the skill of being able to hear God's voice out of the background static. Okay, I think that would probably be a fair way of putting it. Now, that notion that I just described there, that is the voice of God, is available, and it is available for every Christian, this is not taught in the Bible.
Right.
There simply is not any instruction or anything close to any instruction about learning to hear the voice of God. In fact, when Paul heard Jesus, he was unregenerate. There was no skill he had to learn. It was just bang, straightforward. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? No problem. My conviction is when God wants to say something, if he intends to be heard, he's heard, period. And to think that God is trying to talk, but we're thwarting it, it to me is a libel against the power of God. So I assess that kind of mysticism, the particular claim that Dallas is making here, and there may be other mystical elements that he believes in that I'm not speaking to at this moment, but that particular claim needs to be verified by Scripture. And the verses that I've seen used to verify this simply do not they do not rise to the task. And I don't know all of them that Dallas uses. I know one. He says, when Jesus said, let him who have ears to hear, let him hear. This is so obviously, to me, not applicable to what he is putting forward. It surprises me.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus gives a parable, and he says, if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. And some people do, and some people don't. And this is God, Jesus communicating through the mystery of parables, something that he wants some people to get and others not to. It has nothing to do with anybody developing this inner ear to hear the voice of God.
Isn't there another level, though, of mysticism where it's all more sublime feelings and the like, and it's not really about attaining some kind of knowledge?
Right, right. And if that's what somebody has in view, I don't have any difficulties with that. I mean, we have Paul talking in Philippians many times about the joy of the Lord, and it's the joy book because he uses the word joy so much. There is certainly an affective element of Christianity that is borne testimony to by many, many different passages, and this I do not at all deny. I think different people have different levels of that. Mine, and I've mentioned this on the air, is rather low. That is, I don't have a strong affective element. It isn't like I'm getting buzzed by God all the time. But other people seem to be getting a lot of that stuff, and I don't know how to turn that juice on. If I did, I'd turn the dial up way up, you know, because it's good stuff when you get it. But I don't think that's the normal Christian life. That is another issue, though, and there's our music, which means our time is up, Greg. Pleasure talking with you again. Thanks for the call. I hope that response was helpful to you. All right, friends, thank you for joining me this, my evening, maybe not yours, but this time. Glad you're with me, and I hope it was helpful to you. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, okay? Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.